both me and Jenny have just finished work. A pretty long day on both of our counts, if I'm not mistaken. So I'm not expecting the most cohesive cutting commentary tonight. Because I have
notes. We'll see.
Oh, you have notes.
I made my notes yesterday. So okay. We'll see.
Okay. Well, I really like these episodes. They are rated on IMDb a little bit lower than the first two episodes. But all of the nerdy podcasts I listen to about Game of Thrones have all said that these are the best episodes. So I think there's a very there's a distinction between like the casual viewers liking episodes one and two more, and then the nerdier following liking episodes three and four more.
I can say that they've gotten better. It feels like they've gotten better each episode so far this season.
I will say I get both sides of it.
Mm.
I think one of the first notes that I made for at least episode three, the first of the two that we're talking about, is just anxiety. The episode was so stressful to be put in Rhaenyra's shoes during all of it, and just every single thing's just not ready, not right, not prepared. And it does feel emotionally like this upward spiral towards tragedy. And so that doesn't necessarily make it the most enjoyable thing to watch in the same way as like the first two episodes. It felt like they could be building upwards.
Yeah.
And obviously this is the decline, and it's fascinating and it's juicy. And so from a fan's perspective, I can really enjoy that. But from a kind of, it's the cynical feeling that put me off watching the second episode is the, oh no, it was so horrible at the end of the first episode and everything's getting dark and miserable. And so me as an optimist is like, no, I don't want to watch the misery. But like, as a fan, I'm like, yes, give me all of it.
I mean, and now we've got a real Game of Thrones Nazi as well.
Andal supremacist or tower supremacist.
Oh my god. The things he was saying.
He's like Dennis Reynolds. Like, oh my god. He's Orman, you know, they needed a new villain to take Otto's shoes, and they found a good one. An interesting one to watch for sure.
He is an interesting watch. But I've got to be honest, some of this, like, it did make me uncomfortable because of, you know, what he was saying. Not in a bad way, like because the thing is, it's like it's so sinister, and the things he says, how like, well, put it this way, the character writing in this season has definitely been like a jump up in quality. Like the characters definitely seem to have a lot more flesh on the bones this time around.
Yeah. And especially ones that I criticized last season, like Damon, I think is being written really great, and Rhaena really too. The one scene we got her, and I thought that I thought it was acted well, and you know, I actually, you know, I've warmed up to where they're going with that story. So kudos to the writers for that one.
That's very interesting. From where you were feeling last week or two weeks ago. Now for you to be like, I'm warm into it. That's a big
step. I guess
step.
I just sort of like accept, you know, I've credited the writers and I've just sort of, you know, accepted it is what it is. But you know, they're doing better than I feared.
This definitely feels like it's gotten out of the doldrums of everything we didn't like about the first season two, to a degree. Like it is on an upward trajectory. Another character I actually find interestingly interesting is I'm going to try and find him on the thing. It's Manderly. Where's Manderly? Where's Mr. Manderly?
There. I just wrote, what's his deal? Like, I'm so interested. I find it very fascinating from a audience perspective that we know nothing about him other than he has a vague sense of humor and seems to have some level of common sense. And like Rhaenyra said, he has interested me. He's caught my attention or something. And I'm like, he's caught my attention. Like he's been in what? He's probably had like seven lines of dialogue.
Yes.
I like having him around. he seems like fun, and he seems logical, and there's something really delightful about a character who can be self-deprecating, and it humanizes them. And I feel like so many of these characters are so self-serious and can't laugh at themselves, and I say that's probably a massive flaw of all of the Targaryens, the Targaryen pride. I would say just Rhaenyra, but definitely all the Targaryens. They have this such a sense of pride that they can't laugh at themselves. They can't find humor in what's happening around them. And so it's very humanizing to have a character who does do that. And also, like, if Rhaenyra could learn the Tyrion lesson of wear your flaws as your shield, like laugh at your enemies who are laughing at you, then she wouldn't be in such a bad situation a lot of the way. If she could find the self-assurance in her soul to be able to laugh at her enemies and genuinely, you know, let that part of herself go, she'd be in a much better way in a lot of senses.
Watching here where he's going to go is going to be interesting. He might be the is it the Lionel? No, the strong, the was Hand of the King for Viserys.
Simon.
Lionel Strong? Yeah, Lionel. I want to say Lionel Strong. It's Lionel Strong, isn't
it? Yeah, definitely similar energy. I think Lionel Strong was a bit more serious, but that having that someone who can take the hint and is not going to lie is really like. Nice.
Yeah. He might. So, as from what I've understood of him as a character, he's quite a learned person. He's quite. And I suppose if you're a Manderly, you're going to be up there. Where's the Manderly place again? It's the biggest city in the north, isn't it?
White Harbor.
That's it, yeah. And so if you're Lord of White Harbor, presuming he's Lord of White Harbor, he might be a, you know, brother of a lord or something like that. But if you're, you know, if you're
second
running
son.
Something like that,
So the Manderlys, they were a house from the south, but they moved to the north. They were forced into exile by House Gardner, and the House Stark accepted and welcomed them in and gave them White Harbor. That their history.
And it's the richest town in the north, I'd imagine. I'm sure they must have like mentioned that in passing, because it's the trade port in the north, which I'm surprised that we haven't actually even seen. We haven't seen White Harbor in the show yet, have we?
No, I don't think we've seen it. I don't think it's been.
Where was the big like first White Walker fight sequence with John?
That was Hardhome, right?
That's
north of the wall.
That's north of the wall. Yeah, I feel like it's interesting to like. I feel like there's a bit of book/TV show metagaming happening with Manderly, in that we know, I'm saying the royal we here, know that he's associated with the Starks and the North. And so therefore we're kind of applying some virtue to his character a little bit. Like the Starks are basically noble and good, and therefore he's associated with them, so he's basically noble and good. Because I believe I'm remembering right, and I need to potentially rewatch some old Shiflex videos from back in the day. But wasn't the Manderlys being like the primary part of the kind of Great Northern conspiracy? They were one of the ones who were trying to get like the real Sansa back on the like back to rights and defeat the Boltons, like the North doesn't forget type thing. Obviously, that's far in the future, but the kind of, you know, the lifeblood of Game of Thrones is the idea of family loyalty and family values passing through generations. So he's had like no dialogue. And the fact that he, like, Daemon comes in and is like, I think you think of yourself smart. Well, I'm the smartest person in the room. And the fact that he's then like, you know, taken. Like, he's that alone proves that he's smart. Like, he probably is. In many ways, slightly smarter than Daemon.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
He knows when to take a hint.
But I also love how Daemon was just like, "You can't be smart. I'm the smart one."
Yep.
I'm smart.
Like, being the loudest doesn't necessarily mean being the smartest. He's like, this is Daemon sat next to Orwell. Like,
yes. Oh yeah, who is definitely the smartest?
Yeah.
Or and also Missaria.
I'd like to see Daemon forge his however many chains. Like, you know, he'd obviously get part of the Valyrian one, but like all the rest, I'm like, dude, really?
Hang on, Valyrian is magic though, isn't it? Does he get magic?
I don't know whether Dragons or not. It would be interesting because I don't think we've ever had Targaryens. I think the test for the Valyrian ring is lighting a black candle or something.
Yes,
I feel like we haven't had many Targaryens attempt that. And that would be another one to, like, if we could find tangible evidence that that is something that Targaryens could do.
Yeah.
Then that would be evidence of magical blood or whatever else. Yeah, I think he'd have maybe a good shot at that. He might have a good shot at, I don't know. Is there a chain for linguistics because he's multilingual? I mean, is there though? I think of Daemon as being wily. I don't necessarily think of him being.
He's ballsy. Smart. No, he's the one. He's the guy where confident. Like he's not intelligent. He's just really confident. Mm-hmm. And some people buy that into intelligence. Easy. I mean, he's like everyone in the aristocracy can like read and write and has a certain level of education. But Daemon, yeah, his bravado and his what's the thing where you just like your
assuredness?
Yeah, that kind of thing is why he does so well. Like it's just brash, sort of like masculine confidence. Do you know what I mean? Like that.
He's what's the line from Robin Hood Men in Tights? He's a headstrong and cocksure, or is it the other way around?
Yeah. That's the one. I'll tell you what, I watched Spaceballs with Rosie again the other night. Oh my God, that's an awful movie. That is terrible.
It's not my favourite, I'm not going to lie. I feel like Robin Hood gets more of the... I feel like Spaceballs isn't reverent to the source material. I feel like Mel Brooks looked at Star Wars and went, that's dumb.
Yeah.
Let me say that's dumb in a movie. While I feel like when he looked at Robin Hood, he was like, there are aspects of this that is really stupid, but a lot of aspects that are really, like, can be funny in certain contexts. I feel like Robin Hood Men in Tights is much more referential, and therefore that you can tell with parodies when there's love to the original source material. Mm. Anyway, I'm not, I could talk about Robin Hood Men in Tights for ages.
Although I don't know if
we've got two episodes of House of the Dragon to get through.
Although just as a small tangent, I don't know if you're familiar with the other podcast I do, Space Virgins, where we like do film reviews and stuff of usually interesting films, not necessarily good films, just interesting films. And we should definitely have each of you as a guest on at some point. And you know, pick
sure.
I'm always up for talking about something.
Yeah, because I was looking at Max's website recently. You got to flesh out more reviews. I want your.
I know. I was just building it, you know, as a proof of it, like, you know, that I could, you know, do it. So I'm going to add more for sure.
I've got a little table on mine. I haven't done reviews, but I've got like a little, you know, just like scale 1 to 10 list of, you know, big long list. But no, I'm always interested on that kind of stuff, and I'm trying to find as many like websites that people have made themselves to follow as possible. Like I think that's a little bit about how we can reclaim the internet, I reckon. Not to, you know, just
I agree.
Had this weird thought process regarding YouTube lately that there's like, and this is one of those ones that I've been having. It's such a strange thought process, but I've been craving unusual faces because there's so much filters and procedures that people are having. Like, as soon as I see a genuine older person or someone who is like unusual looking in some way, I'm like, yes, I want to hang out with you and watch you. Like I'm craving unusual faces, and I didn't realize it until very recently, and then I can't stop thinking about that, how I'm just not interested in the doom scrolling and brain rot where you just see the same faces again and again and again and again. And so part of that is I'm like, I've got an unusual face, I should be on the internet more.
I mean, that's like how it used to be, isn't it?
AI can't fake my face yet because I don't do enough interneting, and also I have not a traditionally basic face. Like, no, you know, I'm not going to be up the top of Instagram anytime soon.
I respect, like, I mean, obviously when I'm on the buses, like, all kinds of people take the bus, and I always respect, like, I like people that have thrown themselves into their own style, whatever it is. Like, they've just done their own thing. They're not dressing for someone else. They're just, you know, embracing themselves.
Like, I go out in public and I see such a variety of faces, and you go on the internet and it's such a small number of faces. Yep. And I didn't quite realize that until recently. And since then, I've been like trying to like diversify my feed, and not, because a lot of, when you have these quintessential beautiful faces, I'm starting to not believe they're even real people anymore, because there's so much opportunity for fakeness. And I'm probably doing a huge disservice to some people who are just naturally very beautiful.
They have enough going for them.
I want some tangible.
But I don't.
Thing
I don't.
To hold on to.
I don't know how much beauty even comes into this, because it's just, to me at least, it's just different, just unusual. Unusual is a bit of a strong word, but just like, not having this desperate urge to fit in. I kind of like it.
Yeah. The default.
Yeah. It's not. Yeah. Like, it's kind of hard to explain, but it's just a little bit like thinking for yourself.
And it's very hard not to start that conversation and break into the, well, I'm not like other girls, or like I'm the only seen kid in my class, and therefore I'm cool and unique and unusual. And then you look around all your friends and they're doing exactly the same thing. So it's a hard emotional thing to kind of communicate, but it's a craving for reality versus the internet. As it currently stands,
it's a little bit like a revival.
Put more reality back on.
It's kind of like a revival of punk, I feel. Mm-hmm. Like, what, because like, if you look at, I've started listening to Radio 3 because I've got an old car and I always get bored of CDs. There's only so many CDs you can have, and then you just get bored of it. And I'm not the biggest music fan. I get bored of the music I've got. So I've got Radio 3 on, which you think of as the classical music channel. So you've got Radio 1, that's trendy new stuff. Radio 2, that's like oldies, stuff your dad would listen to. Radio 4, that's usually talk shows and the Archers. And then I think there are like other radios that are like, you know, British Asian radio and all that kind of stuff. But Radio 3 is, to me, like, it's the punkest radio station, because they will have stuff that all other radio stations are too scared to put on. Classic FM, yeah, it's great if you like Vivaldi and adverts, but Radio 3, they'll have like opera and stuff on, or they'll have like Evensong at like one of the churches in Cambridge or something. Do you know what I mean? And it'll be, or they'll have like the sound of a coffee shop, and then like the background noise, and then they'll twist it into music. There was this one guy, I think he was like known as like Black Mozart or something, and what he did was he had this keyboard and he brought it in the studio with him, and he demonstrated how playing classical music in like different keys, or going playing it minor instead of major, or major instead of minor, or all this kind of stuff, or changing the tempo of like iconic bits, and how much that changed the music. And he was just playing around with it, and I just was thinking as I was listening, it's like you'd never get that anywhere else on radio, because they'll just do sometimes, I gotta admit, their experimental jazz is a bit of a bridge too far for me, because that's just wild. I don't understand it. I don't get it. It confuses me. But, you know, fair play for putting it on. And you know, how they talk about the music as well. It's not just like stuff that you hear on car adverts. It's like, it's really random stuff. There was, I think it's The Marriage of Figaro they were covering as well. And, yeah, it's just like, but the stuff that they have there, it often tends to be stuff that is just like, fuck it, let's just have something like completely out of left field sometimes. And I can completely respect them for that. Sorry, that was a tangent that had no purpose whatsoever. Sorry about that, guys.
No worries. I was just wondering how much of that conversation Max had a comprehension of.
Like, I mean, you know, I don't know the ins and outs of British radio, but I followed what you're saying.
Okay, I'll tell you what would be a bizarre, like, American analog for this is, you know, in America, you've got the really local talk radio stations.
Yeah.
It's probably like a little bit like that, where they've got the means to just like talk about wild conspiracy theories or.
Oh yeah. You get out in some places, you drive in and you start tuning around on the radio. You'll hear some mostly right wing crazy stuff. More, you know, like Jesus music.
Yeah.
Spooky yeah. music though. Did any of you guys notice the absolutely crazy music cue when Rhaenyra hallucinated Jace?
Oh my god, the whole score for the episode
that was
3
so unnerving.
Yeah. It was horrifying.
I hated it so much. It was so stressful.
Yeah, it's just
I really liked how episode 3, you know, apart from the cold open, just completely focused on Rhaenyra's perspective and like just her feelings and, you know, the aftermath of Sun and
Like, it's fascinating to me from the conversation. So about the tree or the caterpillars or whatever it was that Helena was talking about in episode 2, coming too early.
Yes.
Having had this episode with Rhaenyra, where, like, if she had just not listened to Daemon, just waited out for, like, another couple of weeks in Dragonstone, waited for the... like waited to resolve any issues with her small council and build up her small council to a small council she can trust on Dragonstone, then she could have taken them with her. She would have probably been there with Daemon during the cold open, and maybe would have potentially worked out maybe what was going on a little bit earlier. Obviously, it's not until Alicent identifies the boy in the first place, but there is potential for that to have happened, or for what's he called? To have made it to Tumbleton, and then she could have gone in with the army straight away. There's potential for whatever's happening with Aegmund and Vhagar to be resolved. Mm-hmm. That could have happened. She could have fought Vhagar, you know, with all of her dragons out in the wilds. She could have come to King's Landing as a victor and a someone to relieve people if she'd just given a bit more time. There's so many things. If she'd just given a bit more time, like Corlys might have identified his bastards to her but not asked them to be legitimized, so she could have established Joffrey as her heir. There's so much stuff. If she had more time before coming to King's Landing, like they wouldn't, like if she hadn't been so angry or killed been persuaded to immediately kill Ironrod and Alicent's dad.
Otto Hightower.
Otto. So that would have left her with more information about where the money is. Like, if she'd left it a bit longer as well, so that the people of King's Landing were really struggling and it'd be made known publicly that the crown was in deficit, and then she comes as the person who, like, coming to a town that, like, is known that there's no money. Like, there's so much stuff that she could have done. And she, like, she has no one to trust.
It seems like a lot of unforced errors on her part, but you also just have to think, you know, she's just, like, as, you know, the monarch, she has to think of so much that it's just, like, too much, and she's dealing with all this trauma and losing her sons and everything. One part that I thought was really great, acting wise and writing wise, of the episode 3 was, Chris, I don't know if you want to pull it up at 33 minutes and 20 seconds. When she's like, I'm awash with dilemmas and deficiencies. That whole bit just really, like, showed the point of her just, like, you know, getting to a breaking point.
Yeah.
Well, I also enjoyed the fact that she's kind of revealed a lot of her, like, inner soul to her dragon seeds more than maybe she necessarily should have done, but, like, theoretically she's got to trust them. So, like, I think Ulf has a really good read on her, whether or not that's intentional or not.
Yeah.
Hence why he was able to, like, poke the bear immediately with the graffiti. Like, I think Ulf has a really good reading on people, and he's immediately seen through this veneer of royalty. Like, he's got a dragon, she's got a dragon, they're basically equal. They all should be doing the same thing.
I think you might be giving a little bit too much. I think Ulf is just a chancer. Like, I think he's
a chancer, but he knows.
Can we talk about Ulf? we'll talk about all the dragon seeds, but specifically Ulf. They're really, you know, his list of grievances with Rhaenyra is only growing.
Damon's just being a dick to him continuously.
Damon's being a dick to him. The whole them styling, taking their, you know, creating their surnames, basically, and Ulf wanting to go with Targaryen. You know, it's funny. It was played for laughs, and it was a good bit. But like, you know, it also shows like he just maybe wants to be accepted, and Rhaenyra's like, oh no, that's ridiculous. Like, you know.
Yeah,
I do like how, like, just that moment of her going, no, that's ridiculous, is just so exasperated mother. There's just something about the way that she just, like, it was completely, it wasn't thought out, it was just like, what, no, you can't have ice cream for breakfast. No, you can't.
See, the question is, right, okay, okay, sorry if this is a spoiler, Jenny. I don't know if this is, because this is quite widely known.
But I think I probably have been spoiled for it.
Yeah, Ulf changes sides.
Yes.
Yeah, that's the... Okay, and we can see this coming, so it's not the hugest spoiler in the world. I don't know if it's a spoiler, because it's obviously...
I think it's been very, very continuously and regularly signposted. Like, in the same way that... Ned's death was signposted. Mm. It's not like, it might still feel like a twist to some people, but in hindsight, mm-hmm. you look back and go, "Oh yeah, obviously." So if you know it, you know it.
Yeah, and I do wonder if she would have made him a Targaryen, would he have still, and you know, the various trappings that go in with that, right? Let's just say she embraces the Queen of Bastards moniker, right? A little bit like, was it Maegar? Baelor the Blessed, one of the kings, the Blackfyre Rebellion king, the king that started the Blackfyre Rebellion, legitimized all the bastards on...
Aegon the Fifth.
Something like that, yeah. Is that Aegon the Unworthy?
That was quick, Max. Blimey. That was fast.
I think it's the Fifth or the Fourth. I'm pretty sure it's the Fifth.
If she'd have done something a little, like, not on her deathbed, of course, but like... just sort of normalized bastardry.
Aegon the Fourth.
Fourth.
Okay. The Fifth is Egg.
Yeah.
Egg is, I don't want to put disrespect on Egg.
No, absolutely not. Would he have, we obviously don't know this yet. Would he have turned coat, or...
I think Ulf is grasping. I think he would have satisfied him.
Yeah, he would turn no matter what. He's, you know, I think that's his character.
And the fact that, like, the first thing he's asked for a castle, he's asked for title, he's asked for land and title for his buddies. Like, I don't think he would ever stop. I think there's, what's the line from the first season about, I'm yet to meet a man who lacks the appetite for absolute power?
Oh, yeah, I know
Like, I feel like Ulf is maybe the epitome of that. Like, I think he would just go, oh, but can I have more? Like, he just wants to have fun with his friends, but can he have more? Can he have more? I still think it would have been sensible for Rhaenyra to arbitrarily give them some castles or some land.
Yeah.
In anticipation
of
the, like, obviously, the whole dragon seed thing was such a gambit. She doesn't know if someone's going to claim a dragon, but once the dragons have been claimed, she could have at least said, okay, you can build a new castle. You can have a castle in this area, or you can have a castle in this area. Like, just giving them something tangible to hold on to, because, like, it's just to give people nukes.
I think you're definitely right.
Yeah.
But is this like typical Targaryen hubris in believing that, well, the default is to be loyal to the Targaryens? Why would you just not be, you know? Ulf has been lifted out from the gutter as well. So it's maybe naive to think, but not unreasonable, that to think that he's grateful. But obviously,
It it's a very consistent characterization of Rhaemyra to be naive and uneducated about the needs and wants of small folk. It's something so interesting that Missari is whispering in her ear about small folk, small folk, small folk, and she is at least putting on a show. But even back to season one, when little Rhaemyra went off to the sex club with Daemon, she was like, it doesn't matter what they think, it doesn't matter. And even now, like, she doesn't understand the plight of the small folk. She does have a blind spot with them, for definite. So I think she doesn't understand necessarily that they can aspire to more. A big gap there with her. Like, obviously she doesn't necessarily understand the nobles either, even though that scene was badass. I do find it interesting as well, the fact that she's set up, I can never remember which one's Alan and which one's Adam. Is Adam the dragon rider?
Yeah, Adam's the dragon rider. Yeah.
Like, the fact that she's constantly telling him to his face that he is like the like blessed representation of her right of kings, and then also still insulting him.
Yeah.
By not allowing him to take his father's name. It's complicated. Their relationship is so scary.
I know she's like nervous about, you know, the bastard thing, but honestly, like, Corlys is a essential linchpin in the entire operation. Pissing him off was just stupid. Like,
I mean, it's more complicated than that. I think, like, that there's misogyny in bastardry. Like, a man can claim bastards, and it just means that he's virile and he's gone out and done what he needs to do and he can bring his bastards up. If a woman claims bastards, then she is a bitch and a spoiled something and a whore and all these other things. It's like, if in the same, like, obviously Cersei wasn't a designated heir to the throne. If Cersei had been found guilty of adultery, she would have been beheaded, and of bearing bastards. Well, she would have been beheaded or sent to the wall. Like, women who have bastards in those positions can, like the equivalent of being stoned to death. Like, it's not just her.
I gotta say, I don't think, like, Cersei would have that.
Cersei wouldn't have that, but Cersei wouldn't have that in season, like.
But Cersei's a special case. I will give you that. Cersei is a special case,
but so is Rhaemyra. Rhaemyra is the only female heir to the throne. If she had like enough humor to laugh it off and say, haha, no, it's fine, I can be mother of bastards, but my children are definitely just, she, like, it's more than just he's worried about the throne. Like, it would, like, what would happen to Joffrey? Like, if she, like, it's more than just, I get the Corlys, I can understand why Corlys is totally, totally. Also, like, what about Rhaenyra and Baela? Like, if she raises up, I think it's part of the reason why they aged up Adam and Alan as well, is so that if she legitimizes Adam and Alan, then Baela and Rhaenyra would be cut out of the succession, Driftmark, because they're younger.
Yeah, but Driftmark barely exists
younger
anymore.
And they're female, and then, well, pun?
Well, Driftmark is basically burnt down.
The heir to Driftmark, like, you know, there is technically, he holds land.
Okay.
It's not just the physical castle, it's the land surrounding it.
The status.
The position, the title. Yeah. Like, the status, the, you know, all of this stuff about having legacy. If she raises two bastards who are older and male, then she is showing that she's overstepping to current female, or at least one current female heir. And so doesn't that make her hypocritical as everything else?
They had a conversation, I think it was in season one, with the older sister. Is that Rhaena or Baela? Baela. Did she say, I'm, which side did she land down on? Did she say, I'm salt and sea, or I'm fire and blood?
Don't know if she was talking about herself. I think she might have been talking about someone else.
No, she was offered something. And she declined it. Did she decline
That's not how inheritance works. Like, obviously, Luke didn't want Driftmark, but he was going to get it. So technically, this is the other thing. If it doesn't go to Rhaenyra or Baela, it should technically go to Joffrey or Viserys II or the Younger or Aegon the Younger. Through, like, it's a twisted, like, it's a family wreath. But it's more complicated than just she doesn't want to look like the Queen of Bastards. Other things. And it's interesting as well, the whole theme of this is Adam and Alan are basically the perfect children for Corlys. They are, he has been left a gift in his bastardy. They are young, strong, male, virile. One of them's an excellent ship hand, excellent captain, and one of them's a dragon rider. Like, they are the perfect offspring for him, and they are bastards, while all other sons and all other children in this show are somehow failures to their parents. Every single other character is a failure to their parents, 50% of them because they're women, the other 50% because they are not suitable. Like, Daemon is not suitable to be heir. There's a reason why he's not made heir. Aemon and Aegon are just not good offspring, while Corlys has this gift of these perfect specimens of men that fit specimens. All of the criteria for what he wants in his descendants. And the only thing wrong with them is they're bastards. And so it's this weird, it's so tense, and I feel so bad for both of them. Like, I get his anger.
Although it
is more complicated than her being like, oh yeah, you can have it. It's a bad political thing. It's like, literally, if I say yes, then does that not make it? It's complicated. It's complicated, and I like it. It's good drama.
I'm also like, can he not unbastard them, naturalize them himself? I don't quite understand why the queen needs to get involved, because didn't Roos Bolton naturalize Ramsay? Can it just not be done by?
I can't remember if you need a royal thing, but they can be naturalized, I'm sure. This is what I was saying as well with the timeline, is if he had naturalized them before she came to the throne, then that would have been different to if she's now on the throne. There's a slightly different political situation. If he'd let her know beforehand and asked before she came to the throne, it might be a slightly different thing than her physically being there and having so many battles to fight.
Yeah, also, I think one thing that is might change the game a little bit is the culture of bastardry is probably different at this stage than, for example, Game of Thrones, or even Duncan Egg, because the Blackfyre Rebellion probably shifts a lot of what it means to be a noble bastard in the eyes of a lot of people as well. It probably changes a lot of norms, which, you know, might have an effect. Like, maybe Rhaenyra could do it, and maybe she'd get away with it, but she might not. It's a gamble. It's not. It's it going against the current culture. Some, you know, maybe it's a roll of the dice, and she feels very precarious. So maybe later might be. Does she say maybe later? Does she say now's not the time?
She does say. She says like later, and it's a postponement, not a denial. She just wants more time. Like, the main thing I think is that she wants to get Joffrey established.
Yeah.
Like, if she can establish Joffrey as an heir and, like, become, like, the reason why she wants the coronation is for legitimacy. So if she can be, like, fully coronated under the rule of the Seven, there's definitely no other primary green contenders to the throne. Joffrey is the heir apparent, and she can also, like, again, have him presented as the heir apparent like she was.
Mm-hmm.
Then she can claim, like, raise up the bastards, because his position is secure. But until that happens, if it was even Viserys or Aegon the Younger, like, she wouldn't have that much tension, or as much tension, because Joffrey is there. It's this, like, oh, it's so hard. I feel so bad. It's so stressful.
I think, to be honest, all things considered, it seems like Corlys kind of understands He doesn't like it, but I think he understands it.
He does kind of crash out on her in public, loudly, in front of a lot of people.
Oh, hang on a minute. Where does he say that? He does,
doesn't he? Well, it's in the Red Keep.
He screams at, yeah, well, in the Red Keep, he screams at Rhaenyra that...
Yeah, he does a... What's the name of his brother? Desmond?
That's it. Desmond.
Yeah. Around 47 minutes, 26 seconds.
Before I watched the episode, because I was a bit belated on watching that episode, that clip had been circulated. Like, clearly the algorithm had worked out that I was a Hot D fan, and literally was showing me shorts of that scene. Reacting to it.
What was that timestamp again, Max?
47:26.
Oh, I see it. Yeah, I see. I have asked for no favor,
I was literally having like the like all the reaction videos we got for like the Red Wedding. It was like that. I had like it being sent to me with people reacting to it, them being like, "Ooh, don't say that, Corlys," but also like she should have. But it is more complicated than yes or no. Like, it's made it very clear this episode how much she's juggling. Yeah, he said the quiet part out loud.
Yes, but okay, all right, yeah, no, I mean, okay, when I say he took it well, or understood, he's not sabotaging the situation. He's gone off to, like, secure the stepstones again, and he's put...
He's gone off to get his anger out.
Yeah, but also...
So there are more toxic things he could have done.
And he put Alan in charge, and Alan had a really great idea. That was a solid idea.
Yeah.
The cat thing.
Yeah. Like, I think Corlys played this to a fucking T, because Alan, I don't know how he does as Hand of the King, but like, I mean, his first idea, cats, which didn't I thought all Otto did cats,
in the book it's Otto.
I think Otto thought about it and never managed to get it done, at least in this particular thing. Which also explains why there's so many freaking cats in Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
Like, there are so many cats in Game of Thrones proper. There's a reason why Arya can chase them. I think he's a really, like, it's giving Rhaenyra the opportunity to build up actually a really good small council. Like,
yeah.
Mandalay's good.
Wild's
good.
We don't know. Let's put a pin in Mandalay.
He's fine.
Like, he could be good.
I mean, we can also put a pin in Daemon and Rosaria.
He's also just supposed to be the fall guy right now, really.
Yeah.
You know, Masari's like, we should point a master coin so someone can take the fall.
Yeah. But if you think about...
And politicking.
But if you think about how...
Give it on the fat man.
If you think about, like, how savvy with money the lord or a lord or senior figure of a port town of that size would be, they're going to be good with money, right? Maybe.
Yeah. Probably.
He's best foot forward. I do like the fact that we've had nearly two seasons of Rhaenyra procrastination. It's been kind of frustrating to see her kind of procrastinate on the actual war. And even though right now there's a huge amount of stuff to do, I do like the fact that she's taking significant steps.
Yeah.
Like, she is hiring a master of coin. She is trying to make herself known as a good figure to the small folk in theory and then cocking it up. And she is, like, putting her foot down with the nobles. Like, it's fun. Like,
feeding the poor. That, like, so here's the thing, right? She feeds the poor at the end of episode 3, and there's graffiti that says Queen of Bastards, where poor people can't read. So
it was definitely the lords.
Definitely the lords.
Did you see the calligraphy on that?
Yeah, and
it was beautiful.
They had
beautiful
the colours, handwriting. The colours of How Strong there. Like, your average Flea Bottom resident is not going to know the colours of How Strong.
Yeah.
Well, I didn't even notice that.
I saw the colors there. I didn't know what they meant, but then I heard someone online say that. And wow, that is really.
See, I very much try and avoid like Alt Shift X and Glidus and all of those sort of things until after we've had our conversations, and then I'll go back and watch those videos. So I don't know whether or not that sort of thing's brought up.
Alt Shift F- yeah. X only does live things now, just like us, I guess. But like,
okay. Either way, like I'm sure Glidus has done something, but I've not watched it until after we've had our conversation.
So yeah, she has got a good. I'm glad she saved Orwell, which, as I understand, doesn't happen in the book. Does it? Yeah, but
I don't know.
I can't know my because we know that all we know that Orwell survives because he's a major source for fire and blood, but yeah. I think he might be kept on beyond. It kind of makes sense because maces are usually attached to a premises, but I believe in the book she takes the guy from Dragonstone with her, but that would be a weird thing to do if you think about it, because maesters aren't generally loyal to the people they're serving, just the build. They're just, you know, usually, maybe, I'd think. But, I mean, we love Orwell. He's excellent. He's one of my favorite characters. So,
And he has some time to shine in these episodes. So
he actually raises the good point that we're seeing some really good stuff from the small council, all of them, really, I think. Which does demonstrate that, yeah, with an uneasy operation for Rhaenyra in episode 3, we are seeing her successfully navigate that and the results in episode 4.
I feel like there is progression between 3 and 4.
Yeah, big progression. Very meaningful progression. She basically turns it around. Like, the unease on episode 3 is like, oh, things are getting tense. This could go either way. Is she going to crash and burn, or is she going to style it out? And it's 70% styled out and 30% punching herself in the face. Because, like, Orwell, for example, he makes the excellent point of, do you actually need the church's blessing? They're not that fond of you anyway. They're not fond of Targaryens. They don't like dragons. And to be honest, if you think about it, the Seven's headquarters is in Old Town. The Maester's the Citadel is in Old Town. High Towers are the lords of Old Town. Old Town seems to be predominantly the opposition seat to Targaryen power, right?
Rhaenyra had Orwell look into the communications, and he said basically that Old Town had been running itself as a kingdom unto itself.
Did you notice that Daeron called what's he called? What's the name of the guy who was weird smell things?
Oh, Ormond.
Ormond.
Ormond. Yeah. He was calling him Sire, not Sir. Sire.
Oh yeah.
Did you guys notice that?
I didn't catch that.
So like my king.
Right.
So that king. That could be Sire, like, you know, my father figure, but we've never had a young male character refer to an older parental figure as Sire. We've only ever had someone refer to someone as their Sire if it's referring to their king. I felt that linked in with the idea of the kingdom of Old Town.
I hadn't even noticed that. Thanks for catching up on that.
Yeah. And it is kind of interesting how, because Daeron is supposed to be like the good one, but obviously Ormond is corrupting him to a degree. It'd be interesting to see sort of where that heads out.
Yeah. It does have a good heart. It seems it's what they're trying to show, that, you know, like, Alicent had the best intention sending him off to live, you know, to be raised as a Hightower, and maybe that was a good thing, but Ormond is, you know, basically Dennis Reynolds as a Hightower.
Yeah. Sorry, I mean, Ormond...
Jenny, have you seen It's Always Sunny? I know, Chris...
I love It's Always Sunny.
I've not seen It's Always Sunny. I've heard good things. I've not seen it.
Ooh, I've dropped my monster condom for my magnum dong.
Yeah.
Okay. One of the best lines ever committed.
With no
TV.
Context.
No context, no.
Okay. Yeah.
I mean, there wasn't that much context in the actual scene, to be honest.
Yeah. So Ormond reminds me, both physically he resembles, and just his rage moment where I love the bit where Darren, knows him and knows is coming. He tells the cupbearer kid, he's like, you need to get out of here, back off, because he's about to flip out. And the rage is just... There's slamming his Valyrian sword, going to your steel sword into the table. It's like, that's something Dennis would do.
Yeah.
There's something, the way that they've created his character as a sort of anti-dragon zealot that is, the zealotry and the faith of the seven and all that stuff, it feels very, like the way that he's grooming seemingly Daeron is very unnerving, and it's got like this very soft, gentle side and then this rageful side, and it's got a level of unnerving that's really scary, and also the fact that he seems to have an unpleasant relationship with young men specifically. So obviously his relationship with Daeron is not pleasant. The fact that the Daeron tries to get the young cupbearer to get out of there seems to me like Daeron being aware that he's going to take it out on a young man. And also the fact that another young man is used as basically a stalling technique to get the blacks to be distracted enough so they can make it to Tumbleton. The fact that he has a supply of young men who he has this grooming relationship with.
Sorry, what was the first, what was that you were referring to? The
Fake Daeron.
That's it, yeah.
So the fact that he has access to this young lad who he has ultimate power over by the fact of kidnapping his mother, to the point where he knows that kid is being sentenced to death or torture or imprisonment or being sent to the wall. If Rhaemyra is very lovely and kind and tries her best and sends him to the wall.
Yeah, but let's also, this kid is being offered. Let's also not forget, though, that some poor rando had to die so that Corlys's gay son could get away.
Yeah. Oh, also another poor. Damon killed a poor rando this episode too. Said he was.
Oh yeah, goat guy.
Yeah, poor old goat guy. But yeah, there's something. The fact that it's very specifically we've now paired Ormond with three young boys. There's something about the zealotry that kind of to me has sort of undertones of abuses suffered from young boys in organized religion. There's something about the way that they're presenting it between the way that his abuse and using structural religion as a way of also controlling. I don't know whether or not I'm reading too much into it.
No, I think you're close.
It made me feel so icky.
I sense it a little bit more like a bit Hitler youthy. I'm not saying it's maybe a bit like the incel thing, but not the incel thing. But
incel comes into it because obviously he speaks about being good and being holy. And then obviously the whole situation with the person he murders at the end is it's one person who was trying to fight to protect women. Mm. He's then had murdered. I feel like there's quite a few themes that apply to modern feminist discussion.
Mm.
So the idea of, I don't know whether or not you guys have been aware of some of the current modern discussions regarding feminism, but the choosing the bear
situation.
Like when the altercation happens with Ormond and the brother-in-law saying, he tried to attack my sister, and the women are saying, look, he tried to attack, sexually assault me, and he broke my arm. And his response is, they called me a cunt. And the idea that the worst thing that these women can do to him is call him a nasty word. And the worst thing he can do to them is entirely physical.
Yeah.
Like, that, I feel like that is very in keeping with the kind of modern discussion of inequality.
The whole Tumbleton thing, I mean, all of it is just, they're just having zero disregard for the people that are there anyway. Do you know what I mean? Like,
they're being used as meat shields.
Yeah, exactly. They're marching in, they're taking what they want, they're quartering troops in just people's houses. Like,
point of quartering them in the houses is so that they can't be attacked. So, like, Rhaenyra's discussion, like, her technique at the end of episode 4 is for her to go house to house. Like, how long does it take for an armed soldier to slit a civilian's throat in their own home?
Mm.
Like,
it keeps
dragons are redundant and soldiers are redundant. Like, there's a reason why they're camped out in people's homes. It's not to hide from the dragons. It's so that, like, there is a no-win situation. How are you meant to save the entire populace?
There's
a reason for it. It's all of these innocent families with soldiers living in their homes who are armed and ready for battle. All as soon as an army approaches Tumbleton, like, every single person get the kill order.
They went somewhere before Tumbleton as well, didn't they? But I can't remember where it is. I think they only mentioned it in passing, but they probably did the same thing there, right?
Don't remember.
I think it was somewhere in the Riverlands. They mentioned, Hightowers were passing through somewhere between Harrenhal and Tumbleton. I'm sure we've heard of it before, but I don't think it was on screen. Maybe I'm imagining it. It's been a long day.
Bless you.
It's right. It's because when you're driving a bus, you've always got to concentrate. Sorry, Jenny?
Yeah, driving is exhausting.
Mm.
Driving is exhausting. Mm. Like, if I'm just driving on my own, but more than an hour, I'm knackered when I get to wherever I get to.
Yeah. I think I've only been driving for about 8 hours today, which is relatively short. It's on the shorter side. 12-13 hours is quite a long day for me, but we basically only work 4 days a week, so I don't know, I'm not really complaining. we do predominantly, there are like days when we do half days and stuff, but we mostly usually do four-day work week, and it's pretty good. But it is shifts, so it doesn't always necessarily mean we get weekends off or anything like that. But to be honest, I kind of like driving on weekends because you don't have commuters, so people are kind of like chill about, people are just a bit more chill on the weekends for the most part. So it's kind of nice. Traffic is a bit more, it's dopier, but chill. So it's like on the weekdays, it's mostly like professional traffic. So commuters, people getting to places, it's a bit more assertive, it's a bit more direct, and people are seem a bit more switched on. But when it's like Saturday and Sunday, I don't know, there's kids in the car listening to, you know, YouTube, PewDiePie, or whatever the kids are listening to now. It's not PewDiePie anymore. He grew up, didn't he? Mr. Tumble. Is Ryan's Toys review still a thing? Did he grow? Is he doing?
I have no idea.
He had a movie a couple years ago that bombed. I heard about that. But I don't. He's got to be like 18 now, right? He's got to be a teenager at least, right?
Yeah. How old is?
I gotta find out. One of my colleagues today. So she's been working with us for a couple
14.
Of years, and
her 14, okay.
A younger sister started working with us this week, and so they're working together. And so they took a picture. Their mum took a picture of them before leaving for work today in their work uniform to pair with a photo of them in their secondary school uniform. And so they sent in this really cute picture of the two of them stood in their sitting room wearing their work uniform, and then next to it, them recreating a pose they did when they were, I think, either late primary school or going into secondary school. I'm assuming they are both starting secondary school.
Hmm.
And she was like, yeah, 2018 was such a long time ago.
Yeah. It still freaks me out when people don't remember 9/11.
Immediate aging.
9/11 was one of my first memories, Chris.
Yeah.
I was like 4. I was like,
oh my God, 4? Oh, yeah. Dear me. I meet full-grown adults that were born after 9/11. It's crazy. Yeah. Sorry, I'm just looking at Ryan's Ryan's.world. Oh, he does a Spanish channel. Animated.
Muy bien.
VTube. He has a VTube. Oh, my God. Oh,
Ryan's World is a VTuber now?
Well, he has a VTube channel. VTube gaming channel.
Oh, God.
Oh, dear. It's so manufactured. I feel bad for him.
You think that he'd make enough money by now that he'd be set for life.
I don't think Ryan has a say in this. I think he's,
well, now.
I think he's a slave. He might be a slave, you know.
Yeah.
Should someone
welfare check?
Well, yeah.
Depends on what state he lives in for the relevant
maybe he's on a ship.
Labor laws. International waters.
International waters, yeah. There's apps. Tag with Ryan. Ryan and Friends. Ryan's World. Merch. Of course, it's a merch page. Ryan'sWorldShop.com. What does he sell? Galaxy Explorers badges, stickers, I think. Mini mystery eggs. Board game. Bestseller bundle. Ryan's World STEM egg. Ryan's Magic Box. And I swear half of these photos, and they're not 14-year-olds. These are photos of him when he's young. Like, they're trying to keep him young.
He's just AI now. He doesn't exist.
Oh, my God.
So the Ryan's World, the movie, was released theatrically in 2024. You know, it has a 1.8 on IMDb.
Oh, my God. The Ryan's
World. Maybe I should check out that movie. That'd be a drunk movie.
Oh my God!
Drunken sound.
That could literally be the worst movie ever made. Oh my God! I don't know. I mean, Do I want to look into that abyss? I feel bad that this has happened. All of this, because it's like I'm looking at this site, and it's like every trend he's been modified for.
Is there Ryan AI? Can I talk to a Ryan AI chatbot?
Oh my god,
there probably is rule whatever it is of the internet.
Rule 34, but with AI. It could be like there are apps, but I don't know if the apps are just a way to get straight to his content. Nickelodeon, Make-A-Wish, Mattel, he's got lots of sponsors. Lunchables, Legoland, Just Play. What the fuck is that? Los Angeles Police Department. Why are they a sponsor? He's a cop. Fuck.
ACAB, including Ryan.
Yeah.
Hopefully he just retires from when he turns 18. You know, hopefully he actually has a trust fund and he can just, like, do whatever and... Not think about the internet ever again.
Yeah, go and just move to Scotland and live a peaceful life. Yeah, I don't know why Scotland.
Yeah, buy some goats.
Well, there's lots of cheap land in Scotland that you can't do much with. That you could just maybe build a house and just be a sheep herder or something. I hope that's not offensive to Scottish people. I'm sorry if it is. I mean, just like because it's mountainous.
Well, you're Welsh. You can make jokes about sheep. You're Welsh.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with sheep. It was the land that
Okay.
Anyway,
I'll be back in a sec. I'm just going to quickly grab some water. But you guys start the next subject. I'll join back in.
Okay. All right. Okay.
I have to drop in like 5 minutes. So.
Is that when your time is up?
Yeah, unfortunately.
All right. Well, I'll tell you what. You call the shots. Which bit? I'll tell you what, because you're a bit more of a book person, right? Do you think Sunfire is actually alive?
Yes. I mean, I think they have to. I think a lot of choices they made, specifically in episode 4, were a way to course correct to make things back in line with the book. I don't know if it was always the plan or if they decided to make these changes after George's blog post, because they're... You know, a couple of things. You know, Sunfire, it's him saying that, Aegon saying that Sunfire is still alive. looks pretty dead. He looks pretty dead to me.
He looks very
dead. But, you know, if anyone's going to know, like, have some kind of psychic connection with him and know something that we don't, it's going to be Aegon, right?
Yeah.
So
I wasn't sure. I put Sunfire TBC on my notes because they're leaving it. Like it seems cut and dried, but it just also seems like they're leaving it vague enough.
Yeah, I mean, he might be barely alive. He might be like 1% alive,
a coma.
But still, I think you know that was something they did to, you know, bring it back in line with the book a little bit more, because, you know, Sunfire does survive for a little longer. And another thing was, you know, they. Helena, they imply Helena's pregnant in this episode.
A little
bit late on Maelor, but, you know, we're still getting Maelor. Well,
all the timelines are a bit squiffy in terms of ages, but I did, like, I'll be interested to see if they do bring Sunfire back. Also, take your bets. Who's the daddy?
Yeah, so is it Aegon or is it Aemon? You know, that could be, you know.
My gut would say Aemon, because he is that guy like, I'm fine with incest, it's okay, it's my duty. I'm a Targaryen, it's how we roll. Where I think...
Also the scene last where she tells Aemon that he's going to die. Mm. It's quite an intimate scene. Like, she's you know, hallucinating into Daemon across a balcony. And there's something very, like, into... Like, there's a... Yeah, it was a very intimate scene.
Yeah.
I mean, it could go either way. I think maybe the more fun way to think of it is that it's secretly Aemon's. I like that they're adding that element back to it, because I think it adds more to the story and the drama.
Okay, now this is a wild theory, but what if something happens where that Aegon uses Targaryen fire magic somehow to bring Sunfire back from the dead in a similar but fire equivalent to what the Night King did with Viserion, maybe. Could he
I mean, I don't know why they'd want to do that to Sunfire. Why wouldn't they do that to one of their own dragons?
Oh no! What I mean is, like, is this like the fire equivalent? Like, can Aegon employ some kind of fire magic to make him a?
I don't know where he'd like hook up with like a red priestess or something that could help him with that, because he doesn't seem very educated on Valyrian magic or anything that he'd know how to do that.
Yeah, he barely speaks Valyrian.
Love. Love is
so that be. I mean, that could be kind of cool if they could find a way to do that.
They'd have signaled that by now, though, wouldn't they?
Yeah, that could be. Yeah, well, they could have that be the thing that, you know, inspires Egg with Summerhall, like way down the line. You know, that
it would be funny to do the equivalent of what was the Red Priest in Game of Thrones proper, not Melisandre, the other one. The one that raised, or would have, in the books, raised Lady Stoneheart. What was his name?
Oh, that was Thoros of Myr.
Thoros of Myr.
Like, and the fact that Thoros of Myr accidentally invoked red mage magic, accidentally brought back
the other guy? Yeah. We'd have, like, some red priest would have appeared on screen if that was the case. This was...
I like the idea that Aegon could accidentally bring his dragon back. Like, it would be kind of funny. I don't suspect it will happen, but that would be kind of funny.
When the words came out of my mouth, I realised how stupid they sounded. But because the thing is, the show would have definitely signalled something towards that. Unless Alice Rivers does something, I guess. But she won't.
Yeah,
I mean...
I don't think she's going to be leaving Harrenhal anytime soon.
No, she's like the ghost.
Also, where is Aemon? You know, like, Kristen Cole and Gwaine show up and they're like, oh, where is Aemon? And last we saw him, he was bleeding out on the floor.
Deep and twisty. Right? Yeah, she managed to convince them that he
they can't hide Vhagar.
Oh, yeah, but they can on the Isle of Faces.
I mean, I was gonna say, like, between the Isle of Faces and the very, like, deep catacombs of Harrenhal, I'm sure it's not hard to find place to find, at least hide Aemond. I feel like it's slightly harder to hide Vega, but it's not impossible. I love her look. I love Alice's look in this. She looks pure. Like, she looks more traditionally medieval than a lot of the designs of Game of Thrones. She looks like a full goth princess witch.
Yeah.
And I just loved her, like, oh my. Like, it was just something, like, it was so fun to have on screen, that energy.
Yeah. Yeah, she's good. She's good. I mean, it might be revealed that she's actually a ghost. No, she can't be a ghost because she gives birth to someone important, doesn't she? Sorry, yep. Is that a spoiler? Okay, well, we can leave it at that.
Yep. I gotta run now.
Okay, no
thanks
worries.
So much. It's been fun. We'll talk about cool. next time.
Yeah. All right, cool.
Sorry, we've got two episodes to talk about, Max, so I'm sorry.
It's okay. No, it's okay. I'm sorry. I'm, you know, got other things I gotta attend to. So
yeah, life happens.
Thanks for the chat.
No worries. Cool.
Good luck with life things.
Bye.
So
I'm not gonna lie, I've still got so many notes. I've got so many
notes. So I think it's pretty certain that Aemond is recovering from his stab wound. That is
it seems very logical.
There's no other signal or clue to go on, right? Like, he's
we have the he flew up on Vega supposed truth, but yeah, it seems to make sense that he's ferreted away somewhere, either on the Isle of Faces or in Harrenhal, and is recovering. Because for such a significant character, they're not going to have his death off screen. Although I'll still be interested to see if Tyland turns up. Like, he's comparatively a much more minor character, but his death wasn't on screen. So, by the rules of film logic, he could still turn up.
So, I'm just trying to avoid spoilers on this one.
Don't worry too much, because again, okay. I have done a little bit more research. Not actively, but osmosis.
Aemond has a pretty spectacularly known death, and
I am aware of it.
Yeah, so we know he's alive. So, and it's such a well-known death that they're almost certainly going to honor it in the film, and not in the film, in the show. And they've been signaling towards that for sure. So,
yeah,
I think we can say with 100% certainty, Alice Rivers is just, you know, keeping him warm. And
she's just fucking around for fun. Yeah.
We also get a little bit more insight into Criston Cole, where he is of the belief that if he stops fighting, he dies, which is kind of true, really, if you think about it.
I mean, he's been depressed for so many years. I also like the idea that he feels like he's aware of the Game of Thrones, and the only way to sidestep it is to play to the lowest common denominator. The only way to sidestep the Game of Thrones and politics is to be a foot soldier. And I like the idea that potentially being hand to the queen, or hand to the king of the green, that's even more just a nail in his coffin. The idea of having to be a political figurehead after everything he's already been through just sounds like absolute hell to him, and that's why he's out here fighting.
Well, yeah, but also
I've really grown like Gawain. I really like
Yeah, he's great. Gawain is kind of like, he's one of my favorite characters a little bit. Like,
yeah.
Because it is very much the case of I don't know, like what he says. Like, I think him and Criston Cole's chemistry is really interesting, because Criston Cole is like, he's got his like philosophy nailed down at this point, right? Like, he knows I'm in too deep. If the Greens lose this war, they're going to hang me. There's no getting around that. And Gawain, who started out when we first saw him, like, you know, he's quite naive, and he's still growing as a character, whereas I think Criston Cole might have arrived at his, and maybe not, I don't know. And I think Gawain is a great, like, the two have been through a lot of the same stuff, but they have the differing perspectives makes that really interesting. that Gwaine is a little bit more. Sorry, what was that, Jenny?
My headphones came out, so I'm very sorry. Right. There was a minor echo for a moment.
No, you're good. Gwaine's perspective in the face of Cole's is just something that I really quite enjoy. It's old Game of Thrones, really, isn't it? Where two people who disagree sort of hash it out, kind of thing, which I really like.
I do find having Gwaine as a foil to Ormond, in that Ormond, like Gwaine thought Ormond was cruel.
Oh yes, yes,
Gwaine
yes.
Thought that of many is what Alicent says, and the fact that obviously Ormond is a much older cousin to Gwaine.
Yeah,
and again, Gwaine's relationship with young men and boys. There's something like the fact that Gwaine has come out decent despite Ormond, but the fact that Gwaine also is knowingly saying he was cruel, knowingly saying, and Alicent dismissing Gwaine, Alicent dismissing Gwaine's opinion as, oh, he's always like that, he's just sensitive, type thought process is a really telling moment. And I really like the idea that you've got these three Hightower lads. You've got Gwaine, you've got Daeron, you've got Ormond, and there's like three generations happening. With three different, and the fact that like Gwaine, you know, goes to Kristen and says a woman was ravished, what are you going to do about it? While Ormond has someone come to him and say a woman has been attacked, what are you going to do about it?
Yeah, I've got to be honest.
Puts on the front. I'm totally gonna be. You've committed sin. You've erred. You're going to be gelded. But also, I'm going to murder her brother.
I get really uncomfortable when they use the word ravished for rape. Is it because the word ravished has become like softened over the years?
Yeah. Well, it's also the you know it, you can use it as like
cheeky in a cheeky way. Yeah.
Like, a cheeky way, you can use it as a innuendo.
Yeah,
it can come with connotations of it being flirtatious liaisons. Yeah.
In fact, that's where you'd expect it to hear it. Really?
Yes, she was ravishing. Is a classic
exactly
thing to say, which is also kind of gross when you take it back into the context for which it was originally intended.
Oh my god! Yeah.
So I find it very interesting, the hypocrisy of, you know, people using religion as a shield and then also allowing abuse to commence and continue. And again, there's just, I really can't quite place why his relationship with young men seems so toxic. But there's, I think probably it's credit to Daeron's acting, the actor who plays Daeron. There's something about how his body language and the way he presents himself that just shows this like completely like he seems kind of broken and terrified, and it's so subtle, but it's enough to make me really go.
He's kind of got a more charming Andrew Tate quality about him, right?
Oh my god!
It's like Andrew Tate with a personality. Like, is Andrew Tate if he made sense? Like, he's got his.
I can understand where you're coming from with that comparison. I wouldn't necessarily see it true. But yeah, I think there's inbuilt misogyny.
Yeah, go with that. I'm sorry. Like, he's got like it's the whole like I've got out of left field views, I'm going to manipulate the situation to gain out of it as much as I can.
I think the horror of it as well is that theoretically his opinions and his attitude is not left field. That's what's kind of scary, is the idea that he represents Old Town, he represents the established. Like he's a representative of Old Town and therefore also kind of the Citadel and of the Maesters. And so it kind of comes and like of the Faith of the Seven. So if he represents all of these archetypal structures of power, And that's how he is presenting himself. Like, that is more scary than just one random nutter. It's the fact that he comes with power and influence, and also comes with this facade of charm and decency.
Yeah.
Like, that's it's one of the things that when they did when Tilda Swinton played the White Witch, they specifically said that one of the directorial cues they took is they talk to children and they say, what's the scariest thing that adults can do? What is scary when you see adults do it? And they said, switches in.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
After presenting calm, but then having these really jarring, aggressive emotions that then immediately disappear again. Because children innately are able to comprehend when something isn't genuine.
Yeah.
And I feel like he's written to have that energy where you don't know where he's coming from, you don't know what's seething underneath, you don't know when it's going to snap and become violent. And it's just, it's a really well-drawn character. And I do like the idea, like the presentation when I pointed out the pomade in episode 2.
Yeah.
And I said, I bet he's an asshole, pomade is a thing. And the fact that they're really putting it down on like the fact that he's super into scents and super like...
Yeah.
Aware of scent. Do you think so? There's two possible things I think could happen that could make this relevant other than a character trait. One is potential poisoning.
Okay. So
you could send him a herb that is particularly nice smelling, but has toxic properties.
Yeah.
One that he might use to perfume himself or inhale. And the other thing is like scent warfare. So dragons are known to be particularly stenchy. Like, it's episode 1 that has Varys going, you smell of dragon.
Yeah.
So is there a way that they can stink him out of Tumbleton? Is there a way that they can make it so aggressively uncomfortable? But the fact that it's been given from Alicent as tangible, like they set it up with a pomade, they set it up with him making his pomade, they set it up with him bathing, and they've set it up with Alicent telling Rhaenyra, if they don't follow through in some capacity, then that is an ultimate failure of Chekhov's gun.
Yeah, it's Chekhov's potpourri.
I also like as well the repeated pattern of particularly Old Tower, High Tower people, sinning and bathing. Like, Alison did it a lot last season with her, you know, she takes it, she was sinking into the bath after her sex with Christian Cole, and she was scrubbing her skin. And then we also have Ormond bathing. And I can't, apart from Viserys and Emma bathing, like, the High Towers are very, like, purifying through water. And then, like, I was thinking about the fact that they're so often paired with purifying through water, purifying, so like Alicent goes for a bathe in the lake, and obviously all of the Targaryens about fire. So, you know, it's a visual theme, but it's a visual theme that they've used consistently for sinners who then wash it away or cover it up with smell. I'm hoping poison. I feel like poison could be a really good...
But I'm hoping for stench warfare. I'm hoping to get...
I'm hoping for dragon shit.
Yeah, Syraxes can do a dive bombing run. Like, let's go for it.
Yeah.
Have a curry the night before. Like, how do you do a dragon scale curry? Lamb vindaloo. With whole lambs.
Eat some particularly ill peasants.
Yeah. This is why I think that like the character development has really come on. Like, obviously we know that the smell's going to come into play because they've hammered it home so much. Like you say, the bathing, the potpourri, he reacts several times to the smell. Also, little bit of interesting.
He knows how to use bleach.
Oh my god, weird. Yeah. That's weird.
Like there was at least one meme going around of Rhaenyra looking at the kid's hair, like how she looks at it, and at least one meme that I saw where she's like, "You can dye them blonde?" Yeah, Rhaenyra, you can. You could have been dyeing your kid's hair blonde this entire time if that's what you so decided.
At least for a couple of years, and then maybe they grow out of it, like in the same way that I'm not as blonde as I was when I was a kid. Can you imagine her just being there being like, I am just bleaching my baby's hair?
She could have got, yeah, she could have avoided this entire shit show. But to juxtapose that, I don't know how the end keeps slipping in there. Aegon, we've not really talked about him much, particularly in regards to episode 4. He kisses a shitty boot. Mm-hmm. So he's obviously...
Yes, well, I put that down as Aegon becoming masonistic. So he's becoming, like, I've got the feeling. So Larys is watching this. And so Larys has already said, like, the tale of your rising will make it even more powerful. If she's said that you're dead and you come back as this, you know, chosen king who's survived and come back from the dead, and now we've also got him kissing the feet of the poor.
Yeah.
And so I can see Larys building this pretty unpleasant scene out as he went into he went to the poor who were suffering, and he kissed the boots of the poor and he lifted them up with him, and really playing to that. He was burnt by dragonfire. You know, all of this sort of thing. I can see it becoming part of his legend.
Yeah.
And so that's what I made for the notes on that. Also, he didn't literally have to kiss it with his lips. He could have booped it with his chin. Like, the guy's up top. He couldn't see.
Yeah, I was thinking that too, actually. He was like, you're really going in for that, man. That's...
Yeah, like, dedication to the cause.
I hope that's like, just dirt.
He's not going to check the lip marks.
I hope that's dirt. I know.
Oh, I doubt it.
It's dungy. It's a bit dungy. Yeah.
A bit dungy.
Yeah. So yeah, this is I guess this is all part of the Aegon redemption arc, really, isn't it? And we're going to see him triumphantly come back, maybe.
I've got, like, if you imagine all of the stuff that's happened to him being presented by Larys to the populace, like him spreading rumors about how Aegon the true heir, Cerys's true heir, Aegon coming back. Having walked among you, kissed the boots of the poor, having laboured, having suffered, you know, and having died and then risen again, it just makes sense. And it's also one of the things where I'm like, oh, saying that he was dead was not a good idea. Like, better for him to like put it out that he fled. He's a coward. He's a pretender. He knew he was in the wrong, and he's fled to the hills. Like, that is a better political thing to say.
Yeah.
He has actually, like, you know, he fled before she arrived, not knowing, like, you know, she doesn't necessarily know he fled from his brother. Like, saying he fled before she arrived, like, that he's a pure coward.
Yeah.
He's a coward who gave up the throne.
Yep.
Like, he gave up the throne when he left King's Landing. He left the poor to their own. He left knowing that the poor could have been burnt alive. And, like, she doesn't have the best political training. And I feel like taking the suggestion from Alison to say he's dead is not a good shout. And it's interesting that she only discussed it with... She'd already made the decision by the time she talked to Missaria. And the other person she discussed it with was the head of the Gold Cloaks. Went like, that is a, you know, good plan or whatever, milady.
But they'll go along with anything.
He's not a political mover.
Yeah.
He's not a political mover. He doesn't know, like, what should be said. And yeah, just, oh, it was a bad decision. And then, like, she doubled down. Like, Alison must have known that if she went to the High Sparrow or the High Septon and said he's dead, the High Septon would have been like, the Silent Sisters haven't been called to attend. Like, he would know, Alison would know that the Silent Sisters always get called. And so she's lied to the High Septon and has been caught in a lie and doubled down. Like, it was just, it was a bad move. It was a bad move set up by, like, it's a good move by Alison.
Mm-hmm.
If it was intentional, I don't know how intentional it was.
No, I think Alison's sort of spiraling at this stage. Or not spiraling, what's the term? Checked out?
Like, yeah, so I don't think she realised how bad of a thing she was suggesting, but like the fact that Rhaemyra just didn't question it and went with it is bad politicking.
It is bad politicking. That is, there's no body. Like, she could have, but then again, I think Orwell kind of makes the point. So what? It's the like I think the setup, because you're familiar with the Maesters against the Dragons conspiracy theory, was it?
Yes, I did write down Dragon conspiracy theory, particularly at the end with whatever Daeron's dragon being locked up.
Yeah.
And being called like a beast and all of this stuff. And like, you know, between the Maesters and Old Tower, between these two episodes, reiterating their thought on dragons being aberrations and abominations, and Targaryens by connection with them being aberrations and abominations.
Yeah.
And the fact that this poor baby dragon is being locked up or being told, you know, you shouldn't be nice to your dragon. so sad. So yeah, anti-dragon conspiracy, yes, definitely.
Because it all sort of converges there. You've got, you know, the Maesters, you've got the Seven that don't like dragons, and now you've got the Hightowers that don't like dragons. It definitely seems to be like the axis of, you know, like King's Landing on one side, Targaryens, dragons, conquest, and then on the other side you've got Old Town, Maesters, Faith of the Seven, Hightowers, established order before the conquest. Because if you think about it, the conquest has not actually been that long. It's like, what, 100 and some years?
And like, interestingly as well, like Daemon's suggestion that he and Rhaenyra just go off and conquer Lys and young T and all of that, and like become like full dragon conquerors, and then come back as Aegon did, as dragon conquerors, having conquered the known world and got all their wealth and gold and all that jazz. See,
that's another fascist, like, story thing, like, when things are going bad, invade someone. Like, that's laced with imperialism. Is it me, or am I just spotting a lot of fascism going on a bit in this?
A lot of fascism. Like, I will say one of the things I was slightly disappointed with, like I'm enjoying Ormond's characterization, and I find him scary and unnerving and creepy. Yeah. And it's nice to have someone who gives you the ick, like a good villain. Like, so far it's been so torn between, we're rooting for Alicent and Rhaenyra. So it's great to have someone that we're like, you're just awful, and not in a Otto Hightower where you're like, I see where you're coming from. You're being smart. Like, this guy is just gross. Mm. And you want to see him fail. But I was really looking forward to the Hightowers versus the Targaryens, particularly with Rhaenyra's turn towards religious Zionism, with her becoming, you know, into the whole Targaryen lore, and the fact that she's chosen by God, and the fact that she believes that Adam coming to her with a dragon is a sign that she deserves to be queen, and that Daemon's had this whole vision quest and believes in the Song of Ice and Fire.
Hmm.
Like, having that juxtaposed with logic in education.
Yeah.
I was really looking forward to that conflict. The idea that the Hightowers are just smart and logical, and particularly when we're talking about the education of women in this world, where Rhaenyra was a cupbearer and then she was allowed to sit on the council, but it seemed from episode 3 that she's never like stood with her father while he was sitting the Iron Throne. Never attend the Iron Throne as the heir apparent in the whole time. Like, she seemed completely, obviously she's overwhelmed, there's a lot of other things going on, but like, the fact that it's all the same problems. It's the same problems her dad lived with. It's the same problems that he had on the small council. It's the same problems that he had. Like, the discussion of sheep and the discussion of the pirates in the gullet and the discussion of not enough money.
Mm.
All of those things were things that Viserys had on his plate. And he could have had her stand with him while he sat the throne, so she knew what to expect.
Yeah.
I they could have had a whole conversation about education, political education, women in education versus men who have had the ultimate Hightower education. And so they made it more zealot than I would like. They seem to make Ormond a true believer in the faith of the Seven, which is fine, and I like it, and I like that it's, but I was anticipating a much more logic versus passions, about much more kind of If that makes sense, I was absolutely looking forward to that.
But then,
dichotomy.
But I guess this shows the similarities between the two sides. They're both using mysticism, as a lever of power, so, just different types of mysticism,
I do like but so much of the series so far has been a look at these equal and opposite comparisons. Look at Alicent versus Rhaemyra. Look at Daemon versus Aemond. Look at Arryk versus the twins.
Oh, Arryk and Eric.
Arryk and Eric. Like, look at these opposing figureheads with such similar things. And I was kind of looking for a shake-up of that status quo.
Yeah.
And I'm fine with it. Like, I don't hate where they've gone with it, but that's what I was anticipating, particularly with the idea of Tumbleton and the idea that he's kind of made dragons redundant through clever, if vicious, military tactics. It's something that Rhaemyra would never have even been able to think of because she wasn't given military training. And that's something that she's talked about in previous seasons where she was like, I wish I'd learned how to use a sword, and I wasn't trained for this. I wasn't trained for war. That any young man should have been trained for war. And they could have done that. And so I'm not mad about what they're doing. I was kind of looking forward to that change in the status quo.
Have you got any more? I'm assuming you got a few more notes.
Because there's
a
lot. Notes.
Yeah, there's a lot.
Do we just speed run some stuff?
Should we speed run it?
Because you have a long day. Okay. Good behavioral aging between Alicent and Rhaemyra. They're both looking older and more mature in this episode.
They do.
I feel like Rhaemyra is speaking with a slightly lower tone. I think she's adjusted her tenor of her voice. So she has a slightly lower tone when she's speaking. I don't know how much of that is. I've just tried to start rewatching season one. But I feel like she's got a slightly higher pitch when she talks, and now she's got a slightly lower tone. I don't know if that's deliberate or whether or not that's me noticing that.
I reckon.
But also, Alicent's dressing has definitely become more as if to imply that she's gained a bit of middle-aged spread. Like, she's still beautiful and gorgeous, but like her dressing is a bit more implying that she's a bit more old.
Also, she's gone blue, which I think is symbolic, because when she's in combat mode, she's green, but now but she wore blue when she was Rhaenyra's friend, and I think
I think
this is a bit of a return to form to young Alicent, where she's withdrawing from the Game of Thrones and is now just hanging out with the people that she loves in the Godswood. And it even seems that despite being a prisoner, she's not entirely unhappy. Like, don't get me wrong, she'd rather be elsewhere.
I think the one thing that she was unhappy about was the fact that I need to double check it, but the room that she and Helena were consigned to, I think that was Helena's bedroom, the one where her kid was killed.
Oh.
And I think that's the reason why she was upset. Yeah. It wasn't that it was being confined to a room. It was being confined to that room.
Oh, okay.
I think. And it's interesting as well that I could be wrong. I need to maybe double check just to make sure. But I think that's where that anxiety was coming from. And the fact she's also anxieting, like playing with her fingernails again.
Yeah.
That's come back. I noticed that in the Godswood. And I like the fact that she and Rhaemyra are talking next to the heart tree. And like Helena's just hanging out with her daughter under the heart tree. There's a lot of like visual reminders of things of the past, in the same way that Rhaemyra talks about ghosts are everywhere, ghosts are in the walls.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I like that. There's lots of echoes. Obviously, the false surrender of Ormond Hightower, among liars.
We knew that. It was like, just going home now, I guess. I guess that's it. We're done. Okay. Disappointed.
All of us are done. It's the fact that Daemon wasn't like, sus, I'm also taking you hostage. Like, he could have also taken him hostage. Like, I get the kid's easier to fit onto a dragon, but also take the commander, who is also the, like, Queen Dowager's cousin. Like, there was multiple... He could have
also taken the dragon.
Well, like, it's hubris, isn't it? Because he thinks, oh, well, you know, worst comes to the worst. We saw how casual Daemon was in that exchange. Like, we knew that there was no threat.
But I think I don't know. I feel like Daemon thinks he's the smartest person in the room, and that's definitely an example of him not quite putting it to the test.
He Daemon loves himself. We all know this. But at the same time, he's there thinking, well, look, if it all goes tits up, I got the biggest dragon and two other dragons. We'll just burn them all. Of course, they go to Tumbleton, and it's like they can't do that without burning all of Tumbleton.
Yeah. Could have done it on the field. Rhaemyra talks about her father's faith in her, yet again, he failed to establish her. He failed to get the lords to swear to her. He apparently didn't bring her into the throne room so that she didn't get any idea that. He didn't educate her. There's so much he didn't do.
He did not do so much. This whole Dance of Dragons is Viserys' failure as a king. Like,
oh, absolutely. Yeah. And like, I also like the fact that Rhaemyra's response to her finally becoming queen is, oh, we should host a tourney, and we should host a joust, and we should have processions, which is what Viserys could do during many, many, many years of peace, and that's what he did with his time. And that's what she thinks is kingly, because that's what Viserys did with his time. And it's her disconnect from actually the war of it all, and the fact that she's not been at peace, and the idea that her concept of what is a signs of legitimacy and acting like a king are completely like dust on the wind in comparison to actual reality. I do like that.
Yeah.
And I do like the line of Alicent, where he lived in his world of his own construction, and we never lived there. And the idea that these women have had to live in the world and deal with the world, and see the reality of what's going on around them, and they never could just, you know, go off and joust or go off and just have sex and have fun without having extreme consequences. They've always had to live in this world. They haven't been able to go off and, you know, have fun and build themselves a Warhammer set.
It's a full working miniature. Would you like to see his Funko Pops? I've been collecting my Funko Pops.
Would you like to see the tapestries?
The tapestries, yeah.
The duty versus love type thing. The idea that Daemon thinks that Rhaemyra still doesn't know herself or knows how to be true to herself. And the idea that I think his perception of her, whether or not this is actually reality or a projection of himself that he's put onto her. She is this fiery Targaryen conquering queen, and she's not falling into that image that he has of her. So is it genuinely that she hasn't found her quote-unquote true self and become this conquering violent woman, or that she was never that person and Daemon has just projected a version of himself onto her? I just found that interesting. And the fact, you know, she could go off to Yi Ti and take her time and let the kingdom fall into madness in its own way, and then, you know, plunder Yi Ti and then come back with gold and wealth and dragons and, you know, a conquering Targaryen queen. She could do that. And, you know, that would give Joffrey time to grow up, and she could come back with this whole story in the same way that I think Aegon's bringing up his story. But I don't think she's moving with the times. Yeah. And it's interesting that also she decided that the council balls was a sign, like a, I can't remember what she said with it. It was a, she said it was like a dead tradition of an old.
Oh, yeah.
Relics of a dead regime.
That's the one.
Which, like, it's interesting that she is trying to incite change. Like, she's got a female Master of Whispers. She's a woman on the throne. She's going without
Masaria. Masaria has earned her place on that council. Like, she'd be foolish to
not to use her.
Yeah.
But it is still going against the establishment. And I feel like potentially, obviously, we've got the foreknowledge of what comes forth in Game of Thrones and the rampant misogyny in Game of Thrones proper, and the fact that there are no women on the small council, and there are, unless they're a queen, all of this stuff that we know is happening, it feeling a little bit like American politics, or, you know, or politics in general that's very binary, where you can have someone come in and go, okay, we're changing this, and 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 we're actively doing changes for the better. And then immediately the next season, you have a reversal of, oh, no, we're not having that change, even if it was positive or negative. No, we're going back to the way it was.
Yeah.
And it kind of feels like that. It feels like, you know, one of the only changes that she's going to put forward that actually sticks is the lack of balls in the council. Everything else is gonna get returned to the status quo, unless there's like a bittersweet small change that happens, which will probably be like an end shot of the series, and it makes me sad. Similarly, the rat dinner, I mentioned that, like, it's one of the things that it's the most active thing. Like, she's actively making changes. Like, is it politically sensible? Not necessarily.
It might be.
But is it making a point in a really effective way, in a more effective way than anything her father did? Like, her father, you know, took out a knife while stood on the Iron Throne, having limped up there, and threatened, what's he called, with cutting out his tongue, and Daemon then chopped off his head. And that meant nothing. Daemond,
yeah.
Like, a man got out a blade while wearing the crown, while on the throne, and it didn't mean anything. By the way, Mimi's coming up to make herself known, so I'm sorry if you hear some meeps.
It's okay, we love the meeps.
She's hungry. But yeah, it did feel very like, you know, I'm not going to put too fine a point on my own personal experience, but my manager is sometimes a bit of a procrastinator. And so sometimes I just do stuff. Like, you know, about 2 years ago, one of my colleagues said, wouldn't it be great if we could do this display thing out here? My boss went, oh, yeah, that would be a good idea. Yeah, I can do that. Yeah, I need to talk to this department and this department. And yeah, it shouldn't take too long. You know what I did this year? I literally did it in about 35 seconds. And so it feels a little bit like just being like, I'm just doing it. Worst comes to the worst, it's a bad decision, but at least I've done something, and it feels very cathartic.
Yeah.
And I like the idea she talked about exercising stewardship.
Yes.
Like, it's a really nice turn of phrase, that it's, you know, and the fact that she's bringing up communal empathy, the idea that if your child was starving, you would do the same thing. Like, she does have good... Like, she's got a high level of charisma. She does have good political language.
Yeah.
Just sometimes her decisions are not great in the long run. And so it's one of those things that it does make it feel even more tragic that there's potential. There's so much potential for it to go better, even though you know it's on a downward spiral.
Yeah, well, yeah, see, that's the... Like, we do know where this story goes, which kind of stifles the... It kind of makes it a tragedy before hope, you know? Like, sorry, you were saying?
Well, that's why I like what I was saying about Orwell a couple of sessions was that, like, it gives you hope for the next generation, because you know this is spiraling towards tragedy. You know that it's not going to end well for the vast majority of our main characters. But you could have some hope that people like Orwell surviving means that some of the changes, some of the good intention might come to fruition. And I'm hoping for some other characters of a similar ilk to be able to survive this incoming desolation. Because I do want to have hope for this world, even though I know that a lot of these decisions are reversed.
Yeah.
I want some hope. I like the fact that in comparison to in the last episode, where they talked about what satisfaction can be gotten by Daemon and what satisfaction can be gotten by Aemond, Ymira talks about what satisfaction she can give to the small folk.
Yeah.
That's the third time in two episodes that we've had that mention of that particular word.
Yeah.
Meaning completely different things. And I did like that as a kind of a poetry between the episodes.
Mm. Yeah, definitely.
You noticed that?
Sorry?
Did you notice it when you watched it?
Yes, I did. Like, it's because we haven't heard that word for it keeps coming up and it's quite, yeah.
It's got a poignancy to it.
Absolutely.
So the question of whether or not she should wear jewelry or wear a sword, and the message that gives is she being a woman who has the heart and soul of a man, or is she being a good, kind queen who is being malevolent to the people? The political messaging of womanhood is interesting. And the fact that when she asks that question, she gets a period. And the fact that as a menstruating human being, it effing sucks.
Yeah.
And you also have to get on with shit. There's a really great political clip I've seen from the 80s where it has a man and a woman, and a man goes, well, a woman shouldn't be a president because women spend a good chunk of their time having periods, which means that they are basically handicapped and ill during that time. And the woman who he's talking to literally turning to him and going, am I on my period right now?
Well, yeah.
You know, can you tell me whether or not me being or not being on my period is affecting my ability to communicate in a political and informed manner? I believe in the books, it's described as when Rhaenyra first sits on the throne, she cuts her legs and it bleeds, and she's seen to be bleeding on the throne.
She does sit on the throne. There is a lot of this, isn't there? Because Viserys pricks himself on the throne.
It's a classic sign of someone being unfit to rule if they're bleeding on the throne.
Yeah.
And so it's interesting that the only form of human bleeding that is not caused by illness or violence is happening on the throne, but it's not from being cut. And I just thought it was a poignant way of kind of bringing in that sentiment, but twisting it. Also, I found it interesting that Rhaenyra didn't drink the potion or whatever she was brought by her handmaid for the pain. She just looked at it. And I don't know whether or not that's kind of the paranoia of what Viserys went through when he was being, he was taking Milk of the Poppy and addling his mind. So I don't know whether or not she's scared of being poisoned or scared of having her mind altered.
Yeah.
And choosing not to drink it, or whether or not it's a callback to the moon tea.
People in can get, you know, people do have been addicted to Milk of the Poppy as well, so I doubt you'd be given
Milk of the Poppy for period cramps, unless you have some severe endometriosis, and she's had multiple babies. So it's probable that it's basically the equivalent of like chamomile tea is meant to be soothing. I don't like chamomile tea, so I've never tried it personally as a remedy for that sort of pain. So it could well be something like chamomile tea. But I just found it interesting that she put it straight down again. In the same way that being served milk, not milk with poppy, moon tea, has an implication. And the idea, I don't think any of the men at the table would have necessarily worked it out, but I feel like people know, and she was thinking that it might show a sign of weakness.
Yeah. Well, it could do, actually, yeah.
Yeah, like showing that you're in pain.
Weak and feeble.
Whatever else you might be feeling. I found it interesting that Alicent snapped and said, will you blame me for all of what men have done? And that's, again, just summarizing her entire character at this point. I enjoyed the questions of Rhaenyra's insanity during episode 3. So the tinnitus, there was buzzing in her ear throughout. the hallucinations, the persistent insomnia that was not resolved, and the idea that she only really kind of feels somewhat eased when she's, you know, sharing a bed with Damon. But even then, she didn't seem restful.
Mm.
Like, it went from the curtains in her bedroom to the curtains in the cart.
Yeah.
So I think she's not sleeping. She's already talked about ghosts in the room, and then she is hallucinating. Obviously by episode 4 she seems to have stabilized a bit, but there is potentially that Targaryen madness coming in. And there's, you know, paranoia about, you know, illness that her father went through. Maybe that also has a mentally degrading effect. And also Damon talking about, you know, her not knowing herself and him kind of wanting that wrath. So just I like the seeds are being sown. I'm not sure what flowers they will bring, but the seeds are being sown for something. I just put very briefly, we all knew it, but the kid was well cast, so the fake Daeron. I think all of us who were super fans immediately knew that we'd seen Daeron. It was the brunette guy, and not the blonde kid. I think all of us had that instinct, but I think people who maybe aren't as crazy fans as we are maybe didn't see it. But I think the kid was really, really well cast. Like, he has the kind of fine Targaryen features that you would expect. I did find it a little bit weird when Rhaenyra was just watching him sleep. Because He's old enough not to be like just having a like a random nap, and it's like fully well lit. There's candles everywhere. It's not like she snuck it in the dark. Like, he's not like a 3 year old. And also, he was given a whittling tool. Like, you don't give a child prisoner
a weapon,
like a supposed royal one. Sharp bladed weapon. I found that bizarre as an option. Like, maybe he could have, like, I don't know, found a nail with which he was carving with or something, or some other means. Like, he could have had like his own like toy or something. Like, I get that it's meant to be reminding her of her children's wooden toys, like the wooden horse that belonged to her son, but like, it just seems bizarre that he was allowed a tool with which to whittle. Like, that just seems so beyond, like, just terrible guarding. The concern about when men get quiet. So Damon is very outspoken, and what's he called? Hand of the King, Corlys, is very outspoken. Both of them they're constantly speaking their mind. They're constantly shouting about what they want. And the fact that Corlys says something along the lines of, "I defer to my queen," and then, like, that's scary. You've pissed them off.
That's
and
the silent treatment.
Very similar. The silent treatment, when they don't, like, when they don't feel like what they are going to say means anything. And so they're just seething with anger. And a very similar thing with Damon when they're talking in Valyrian and she says, you know, "No, we're not going to go to Yi Ti and, you know, do a colonialism. Thank you, mate. We've got, let's sort out what's in front of us first." And then he's like, "Yes, my queen," and F's off. So I did like both of them. When loud, outspoken men are suddenly quiet, it's quite, you know, something's immediately wrong. We've talked about her needing time, but everything needs to happen on a deadline. Again, if they'd gone to Essos and plundered as a thing, she could have come in as a true choir queen. She's still trying to cede to the expectation of Westeros. Even though she's very unsuited to that ceding of Westeros. And I think it's just she's been set with such twisted expectations. And yes, going off and doing a colonialism, genocide, warmongering fire queen is not politically savvy, but it might be more effective in the long run. Damon could be right. The idea that sleeping next to Damon is like a Targaryen like light blanket to this green land, and burning the green doesn't change all of the trauma that lives on in the building. The Red Keep being bigger and smaller, described by what's her name? Oh my god, my brain.
White
Worm.
Yeah, oh my god, what, you've done it to me now. Massaria.
Massaria. So the idea that the Red Keep is described as both bigger and smaller, I think that might be hinting to more maybe tunnel stuff happening in the future.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
The idea that Massaria's got enough knowledge of how buildings work and how architecture works to work out that something's just slightly wrong with the way that the building is designed, like the walls are thicker than they should be, and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Also, I'm interested to see what so Massaria describes a rage, like, so Rhaemyra in the car, in the carriage, says something along the lines of, there's a rage that flows out of me. And Massaria says something along the lines of, I've also known that rage. But, like, I'm pretty sure that Rhaemyra is referring to the rage of having lost her children to bloody war and having her throne stolen. And I'll be interested to know what Massaria's known rage is, because Massaria's whole thing with the populace, I found it very interesting with Massaria and Daemon at the end of the episode, where she immediately saw through the goat leader's skull to be like, who was that? I know you're keeping a secret. I can tell, because she knows him that well.
Yeah.
She knows immediately when he's lying to her, to Rhaemyra. And equally, Daemon snaps back that, like, what's your play? And that kind of reminded me, like, Massaria is always about the small folk. It seems genuine, but it also feels like there's something left unsaid. And between her comments about the rage she's felt and the comments about... And I feel like there might be a late game reveal from Massaria that maybe, I don't know, her mother was killed by a dragon or something like that. Like,
or she might have
something like.
Has she talked about this before? Has she talked about something to do with children? Like, she can't have children now, right? But.
But she said to Daemon that she made the conscious decision to make it so it's impossible for her to bear children. So she chose that.
Oh, okay.
And I think she said that she'd been, like, whoring since she was 14 or something. But I'm starting to get an unfounded theory that maybe there's something in there that I don't think it's quite on the same scale as the anti-dragon conspiracy. Of Old Town, but I can't bring myself to trust all of her motives. Like, she seems so genuine, but she's also coming from that. There's like, she's earned her keep, but she hasn't earned my trust. And there's just little hints in her characterization this season that just make me very suspicious.
We'll
see how that pulls out.
She's won me over. Like, I think she is on the side of the common folk. And if she does go, if she does turn coat, I will be shocked. I will, the Pikachu face.
Okay. So we'll put that in. I just wanted to float that. If it comes to fruition, it comes to fruition. If it doesn't, it doesn't. The dragon pit in Tumbleton. So one dragon keeper survived. And to me, that's almost like leaving one to tell the tale. Like, Ormond very deliberately sent one to Rhaemyra to be like, this is what's happening in Tumbleton. Mm-hmm. I saw a small dragon. People are being held hostage, which makes me think, what's Ormond's next step? Because he's already said that they need to adjust their plans because Gawain's not coming.
Yeah.
So it's the plan isn't ended. Plan was to use the boy to distract them, to get distract the black so they could get to Tumbleton and take the Tumbletown hostage, which he's done that, but there's still steps to happen. And there's also the idea that he's like, there's lots of little details of his plan. Like, he's set up in the town, like, he set up very specifically, like, it could just be that he likes pretty accommodation, but he's taken over the Lord's house. And the fact that they've done Tumbletown, there's a dragon pit there, but there's also, it's a center of trade. So that's also going to really hamper Rhaemyra's potential trade routes reopening, which he really needs money. Is the gold of the king of King's Landing hidden there? We don't know. There's also a dragon pit. There's a dragon pit there. I don't know if there's something in the dragon pit that
The dragon pit is okay. a big thing happens at the Dragon Pit. The Dragon Pit, yeah.
Well, so the Dragon Pit's not in Tumbleton. Dragon Pit.
No,
it's
not. It's King's Landing. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. But, so there is a second Dragon Pit. There's apparently another Dragon Pit in Tumbleton, which I'm like, is there something there? I don't know. But yeah, I found that interesting. And also, it's if we're talking anti-dragon crusade, killing off all of the Dragon Keepers is another step towards the death of the dragons. Like, if you don't have people to care for them who can speak to them and understand them, then it's another nail in that coffin.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I've still got a couple more notes.
I'm sorry.
I know you're tired. Again, talking about kind of current feminism conversations. So one of the current feminism conversations that I am regularly hearing about is the idea of uneven mental load in heterosexual relationships. So oftentimes the male of the relationship will say, oh, well, you were stressed about all this stuff. Why didn't you tell me you wanted to wanted me to do the washing up? And the idea that the homeowner, the home runner, usually a woman in this context, is the one who's doing the washing up every single day, who can see that the plates are dirty, so they do that. They're also planning for the kids, they're planning for the trips, they're packing the bags, they're making the packed lunches, they're doing the clothing, so they have clothing for packed lunches for them to go on school trips, they're remembering the sun cream, they're remembering how often the sun cream uses, and that mental load is being taken predominantly on females within a family. And the idea that being asked to do a job is another thing that, even if the person thinking about delegation, the person thinking about, okay, I need to ask my partner to do a thing instead of them just doing the thing. And the idea that Rhaenyra is having all of this stuff being thrown at her, and a lot, at least it's slightly better by episode four, but at least it seems that she's got to be the one at the top of the thing going, delegating, doing the next thing, doing the next thing, doing the next thing. And her her Hand of the King isn't doing things on his own right. He isn't stepping up and going, okay, you've got all of this stuff, I'm going to be over here sorting out this. Her Master of Whisperers isn't making executive decisions on their own front. So the mental load is falling on Rhaenyra, and it definitely shows the mental load, particularly with all of the stuff. And I also found it interesting callbacks to all of the stuff that was talked about in episode one in the Small Council. Corlys talking about pirates, lords versus the small folks, trying to keep the lords happy with Daemon, but also trying to keep the small folk happy, the trying to save money for the tourney, all of those things were still problems in episode one. It's all repeating, but it's all coming back to the king. And instead of the Hand of the King stepping up and going, actually, no, I've heard your thing about the Stepstones, Corlys, shush, we've got other things. And taking some of that weight off of the ruler, it's all just coming back to Rhaenyra again and again and again. So it was interesting to depict that.
Although, to be fair to Daemon, he goes out and he gets a big bag of gold.
After being told to do it.
But he does have a big bag of gold.
He does do it, but that's the thing, is when we're talking about mental load, it's not even the act of having done the task, it's the act of having to be told to do the task. So it was just an interesting thing. I've already talked about the idea of combating the house to house thing. Makes no sense, like rooting out the soldiers house to house, like the civilians are just dead.
I've heard people say that with Rhaena and the dragon scene with useless Father Daemon, he's got his big bag of gold, and then Syraxes just go, you know, finds sheep
stealer. I enjoyed Caraxes doing his own thing. Like, Daemon is the most experienced dragon rider currently on the show.
Yeah.
Like, he is the one who has had his dragon the longest. His dragon, was his dragon a hatchling in his cradle, or was Caraxes an inherited egg?
I want to say inherited, but I'm not sure. I'll give it a look.
But either way, like he is the person who's been Dragonback the longest of anyone else. Like definitely Rhaemyra is the oldest dragon rider, and she had her egg as a cradle egg. And so like the fact that Caraxes couldn't be brought under sway is quite scary. Like, but I also do love Daemon shushing Caraxes after the fact. Like him just it's great. I did find, so everything about that scene was great. Like the acting was great. I really loved the cinematography of Sheepstealer like blasting fire behind.
Okay, you know, Daemon did not get Caraxes from a hatchling.
Oh, okay. We know who Caraxes was belonged to before Daemon.
Aemon, the Prince of Dragonstone. It is unknown when Caraxes hatched from his egg, but in 72 AC, after Aegon's conquest, he was a young dragon of rideable size. That year, Aemon Targaryen, Prince of Dragonstone and heir apparent of the Iron Throne, claimed Caraxes for the first time. The Dragon Keepers considered him to be the fiercest of all young dragons of the Dragon Pit and nicknamed him Bloodworm, which he's still known as. The Targaryen siblings Alyssa, Balon and Aemon like to fly together on their dragons, Maelys, Vhagar and Caraxes.
Oh, so was it Caraxes was a sibling to... No, okay, no, I'm thinking about... anyway. It's up a generation, but yeah, I do find it quite unnerving that Caraxes is the most experienced, like most experienced dragon rider,
one of the
mature
dragons.
Dragon. And yet he was still like, I smell Rhaenyra. I really love the acting. I really love the cinematography. I really liked the difference in both dragon behavior, and also dragon design, which has been well established. I did find there was nothing in that scene that surprised me. Not a single thing in that scene surprised me. I found that like Daemon said what I thought Daemon would say.
Yeah.
Rhaena said what I thought Rhaena would say. Like I didn't come out of it going, wow, that was amazing. I came out of it going, well, at least that plot point's done.
Well, I've heard people say that they're trying to make Rhaena a little bit more like Nettles in this scene, or not this scene, but like
that. I was expecting her to cut off all her braids, because that's how Nettles is depicted. I think I even said that in a couple of episodes. I did want from that scene, which didn't happen, and this is going to sound really nuts, not necessarily from the Sheepstealer scene. What I really wanted to happen while Daemon had his scene with Jane Arryn was I wanted Caraxes to fly under the moon door.
Oh, yeah.
And Daemon just to leap out of the moon door, like, fuck you, bitch, I'm going out the moon door, and then, like, catch on Caraxes' back. I thought that's what was going to happen.
You thought that was what's going to happen?
Which would have been... I knew it was going to be like, it would be really dumb if it did, but what a baller move. That is such a Daemon mood. Like, to be like, I'm just going to jump out of this thing and be caught by my dragon, bitch. Like, I just, it felt very in character to me. And it seemed a shame to have the moon door as a set piece and not use it to have, at least if the moon door was open, they could have had Caraxes fly underneath it or even have Sheepstealer fly underneath it.
It just seems
a shame to have that set and not use the fact that it's above dragons.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just glad to see it. I think the Eyrie is one of my favourite castles. The one thing that breaks it a little bit for me is kind of knowing that it could never exist. Hang on a minute. I've got to Google to see if it's an actual castle, but I've always assumed... it wasn't because
I think it's digital.
Yeah, it's
and I'm pretty sure it is. I'm almost certain it's digital because one of the Gliders videos that I caught up on for season one is they had the air in the background during the murdering of Rhea Royce, and they said, "Oh yes, it's had an upgrade since Game of Thrones. They've slightly changed the design."
Yeah.
And so I think. And there's reasonable evidence to support that it's entirely fake. And it's such a fantastical castle anyway. I did enjoy
the power play between Jane and Damon during that scene, like the fact that she very bluntly read every single one of his moves.
Yeah.
She knew exactly what he was about. Every single... She takes absolutely no... There's no rope that she gave him with, unless it was with to strangle himself. Like, she conceded, but she did not give him an inch. And I found it very interesting with her talking to her dog, like Lysa used to talk to young Robin. The idea of a woman in power, it has an established female line of succession within the Aerie. But they have oftentimes something to talk to that isn't the men in the room. And the fact that she never got down from, like, she kept that height against Damon. Like, I feel like obviously Damon was coming, you know, to beggar for money. Like, he was aware that he was in a low situation, but not enough for him to, like, I could see him in other houses and other castles marching up those stairs to stand above them. He didn't do that with Jane. And I do find that interesting. And it's probably because, like Missaria, Jane gives him no inches. Like, she does not move a moment. So I really like their interaction. Like, again, there was nothing in the whole of the Aerie scene that surprised me at all. Like, I didn't get excited by it. But it was well done. The acting was great. The merging of plot lines is fine. Again, we never need to criticize the acting or the production value in a Game of Thrones series.
No, it's I think if you go back to the very early Game of Thrones, there was some acting rough edges, but I mean they've long since been smoothed out. Everything here is completely on the money.
A very brief moment of the slow transfer of information, the idea that Alice knew that Rhaenyra had taken the throne, though Gawain and Cole hadn't. So obviously that's some tree seeing and whatnot, but also the fact that those guys are completely out of the loop. By that point, that was episode 4. So by that point, Rhaenyra had hired Lord Manderly or, you know, take him onto the council. She was starting to, like, get things sorted out in the house. She, like, there was stuff that she had made progress on that implied to me that it had been a matter of at least days, if not weeks, of her being queen, and the word hadn't got to Gawain and Cole. So I enjoyed that, just repeating that the world is big and information is slow. Also hinting that Alice has tree vision, so has a quicker view. Also the fact that she knew about Rhaenyra being queen at the same time that Helena was under the tree in the Godswood. Little things like that. I've already talked about Damon and Missaria. No, you can't bullshit a bullshitter. Both of them know something's going on. And I am interested to see what Missaria's final play is. Like, Alan being hanged is, in theory, a bad idea because Corlys is abandoning his duties. But in practice, I think having a calming presence
in the Red Keep,
like someone who is stoic and is calm and is... Alan has a... He's got a steadiness to him that I think is really needed. Like, he'll speak his own mind. He has a backbone, but he's also very humble.
Also,
it's a really good idea in the long run.
He's also in probably more, you know, he's another person on that table, around that table, that is in touch with the common folk. Like, he grew up poor.
And she needs that.
I think this is one of those. I see why Corlys did it, right? He said to Alan, I can't legitimize you, but I can make, you know, help you better yourself. And let's be honest, for anyone, Hand of the King, you know, it's basically prime minister. And you know, you are the, so Corlys must have he either has a world of faith in Adam, which he does because Adam saved his life, or he doesn't give a fuck and is quite happy to, like,
you're on your own, Rhaenyra.
Just like, I fucking get out of here. Alan can do his best or whatever. But honestly, I think it's probably the former. I think he really wants to do something. Adam's got the dragon. He's fine. Alan, who in many ways sacrificed more for Corlys. Like he doesn't have a dragon. He is just a shipwright. Is he a shipwright? No, he's just
I think he's a captain.
He's a captain now, but he works the ships, you know? He's just a hard-working lad. So,
That's what Corlys wants. He wants someone of the salt and sea and not of fire and blood.
I think he feels like Alan deserves more, and that's the best he can give him. Which is the opportunity. You know, Corlys, I can't lift you, you know, says, I can't lift you up. I can't make you my heir, at least not yet, but I can put you in a position where you can make something of yourself. And I think the sort of the poetic twist here is that's actually better, because it's not just a hand-me-down gift. It's actually the opportunity to grow and become a better person. And as we were introduced with that good idea about the cats straight off the bat, it shows that, you know, he thinks about problems. He comes up with solutions that aren't necessarily the obvious ones. And if that's a signal of things to come, I think he's going to be an MVP on the small council.
I think having characters of wisdom over book learning is an interesting, it's one of my favorite things in stories, when people don't necessarily need to be learned to be intelligent. And I do like that about him. And I think he's slow to speak because he thinks deeply. And I think, again, having someone who is salt and water on the the Queen's Council is really helpful for Rhaemyra. I like it. And in a way, if Corlys hadn't made it known that Alan was his bastard, and literally had just been like, hi, I've got this guy, I want to recommend him as my substitute Hand of the Queen while I go off to war. You trust him, you know him, he's really good at what he does. I think he'll make an excellent Hand of the Queen and will act in my stead while I'm absent, or the acting. Yeah. In the same way that Tyrion was the acting Hand of the King for Tywin.
Yeah.
I think if he'd pitched that to Rhaemyra and let her have more time with him to trust him on a personal level, then she would have had a better time being out. And also, the Hand of a King is a known position to the people.
Mm-hmm.
Adam of Hull. Oh, God, darn no, it. Alan Whichever of one Hull. It is.
Alan.
Alan of Hull being one of the people, being raised a Hand of the King, Hand of the Queen, and performing well her duties as the Hand of the Queen. And then it's revealed that actually he was a Valyrian child all along after a year of service.
Mm-hmm.
That's palatable to the people.
Mm-hmm.
Having a known good politician or political figure, then being risen to position of lord and then heir apparent. That's a good progression.
Oh, well, actually, is that actually an attempt, deliberate attempt by Corlys to normalize bastards? Well,
yeah,
it's you put a bastard front and center and it's like, yeah, well, look, bastards are doing well, so yeah.
It's an interesting play. I don't know whether or not Corlys was necessarily thinking that hard at the point where he buggered off to do a war. I think he does think about these things, but I think this one was more of a wrath decision, and I don't know, I could be wrong, but he is tempered. So I can see him making a decision out of anger, and then it happens that it follows through really well in the long run.
No, I think Corlys is way too smart for that. I mean, he's been a politician. He's been on the small council since episode one, season one. So he's got a lifetime of political wits about him, as well as...
He's also got a lifetime of hurt feelings, though.
Yeah, but also...
His daughter was refused, his son was killed, and now his bastards have been denied.
And a lifetime of outwitting pirates on the high seas. I mean, he's got it all, you know, intellectually speaking, really. And he's also probably relatively well-read as well. Like, you know, being a Valerian, you know, he's going to know how to read. He's going to know how to read fucking star maps. So...
Oh, yeah.
There's
no doubt he's intelligent. Yeah. I still think he's capable of acting in reckless anger.
I suppose, possibly, I don't know. Like, I mean, I feel like if you act in reckless anger, you crash your ship, right?
Fair.
You got to keep a level head if you're going to be fighting pirates. I don't know. I mean, we might be reading too much into it, but
that's our entire.
Yeah, but
that should be our subtitle.
Yeah. We're probably reading too much into it. But it's a deliberate play by Corlys, and I think if he puts forward a bastard as Hand of the King and then ends up doing a fucking killer job. Then again, bastards, thumbs up. It's good PR for bastards.
Yeah, it's good PR for bastards. I think in the long run it should pan out. In the long run, it clearly doesn't. Talking of sons, just the fact that she Rhaemyra says to Alicent that she would have spared Daeron. And I think she would have done. Like, she says that to Alicent, you know, I would have spared him. Now, she would have spared him potentially as a political hostage. But also he's, you know, only what, 10 years older than her children. So like they could get along. There could be future female heirs by the line. He would have been a perfectly good political hostage. I don't think she would have killed a child unnecessarily. I think it's a reasonable promise, but I just wanted to point out that Alicent looked quite scared at that point, as if she doubted Rhaemyra. And obviously Rhaemyra was acting in anger, but even in anger, she didn't actually kill the fake Daeron.
And she had to kill Otto. It would have been a high risk. I mean, it would have been a high risk move to bring him on as Hand of the King again after all that. You could have given him the ultimate golden handshake of, you know, come on my council, resume your role, and we'll act like none of this ever happened. However,
I would have thrown him back in the black cells. Like, I feel like that would have been... So then you can torture him or use him as a political hostage. Like, a political hostage against Old Town, Otto Hightower, yes, please. Like, I would have put him back in the dungeons. You could have questioned him. He probably knew where the gold is. Like, even if he wasn't told, he probably had enough knowledge to know where Tyland would have stashed the gold.
Yeah.
Like, he's an excellent political hostage. Like, he's great against Old Town. He's great against the, like... I would have just chucked him back in the cells. I would not put him back as Hand. Like, she had him dismissed from her father's council. Like, she would not let him
come back
as Hand of fucking Queen. Jesus. Like, Daemon would have just killed him on principle.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. It would have looked like such a weak move that the public execution might well have been the thing that she needed to sort of solidify her arrival home.
Like, if I was Daemon and Rhaemyra at that point, I would have said to Daemon, hey, you've got a new chew toy, get the information out of him. And Daemon would have had a fucking blast torturing the heck out of Otto, keeping him alive, at least until they found out things like the treasury, that there's information that he definitely had. And as a political hostage, even as an invisible hostage or an invisible corpse, like, even if he was tortured to death, having an invisible dead Otto is a really powerful hostage. Like, they could claim to have him in the black cells if they hadn't executed him publicly. And that would have been useful.
Okay.
It was a... Yeah, I obviously, again, the whole story of this is, you know, duty versus love, and love comes hand in hand with rage, and, like, you know, these characters are acting emotionally, not politically. So, you know, that clean of an answer would have been far from the situation at hand. But, like, it's, you know, the fact that, again, killing Ironrod is
necessary.
A cathartic thing. I have no idea why Daemon just decided to decapitate him with no reason other than him being a bit of an arsehole. But Ironrod was, you know, a useful political hostage and also could have been interrogated. Like, he would have known where the gold was. Like, acting rashly does not result in good conclusions. So that's one of those things where I'm like, Daemon, calm down sometimes. You really messed up killing Iron Rod. And you obviously didn't know it, but it would have taken literally 5 minutes of questioning. Like, they discovered it, what, the next morning that the coffers were empty? Mm. Like, all they had to do was keeping him alive for, like, 15 hours.
Yeah.
And then they could have... obviously, coulda, woulda, shoulda.
Naturally.
Yeah, it's not a question of whether or not, you make him Hand of the King or you kill him. That there are other options, but I would definitely have kept him on site and either alive to be tortured or dead but hidden.
Yeah.
Because then you could always bring his body out. Like, if you need proof of death, you can always go, look what we found.
Mm.
Like, he was trying to flee or he was sneaking secrets in. But, like, yeah. Dragon corpse. I'm shocked that it was only being sold for people to touch the dragon corpse and not, like, selling the scales or, like prying out the teeth and the claws. I feel like that's the sort of thing the small folks would have done.
Yes, but then Sunfire couldn't come back from the dead.
Yeah, but equally, like, why is Sunfire just being left to rot in the wild? Why has no one from... Like, the whole Green Army was there. The Green Army was there and were able to subtly ship Aegon back in a sealed woolen crate so no one saw how wrecked he was. Mm. And no one thought to, like, bring a dragon on a cart. Like, Sunfire's not that big. He's not humongous. He's not, like, a Vhagar or a Burmothor. Like, they could have wrapped her up and put her on a cart. There's a back entrance to the dragon pit.
Mm-hmm.
I'm mixing my pronouns because I have no idea what gender or sex Sunfire is. But just leaving a dragon, like, out in the middle of nowhere for all the public to be like, oh, yeah, dragons aren't even gods. Look,
well,
at the corpse.
Yeah.
Do you want to touch it?
Is it in the middle of a wall?
I get it's a wall. But, like, I feel like it's a bit silly. And I feel like, having played as much Skyrim as I've played... Dragon bones are worth a lot of gold. They're heavy and they will encumber the heck out of you, but you can make dragon armor. Ooh, dragon armor.
You'd think they'd be very light.
Light armor. Well, you can make in Skyrim, you can make heavy armor out of dragon bones or you can make light armor out of dragon scales.
But yeah, you think.
And it's really cool armor. It's some of the best armor in the game.
Well, yeah, naturally.
Like bird bones.
Yeah, like bird bones, I guess, yeah.
Yeah,
I mean, because they don't need to be armored. They're fire breathers. I mean, they could be fireproof, but you don't need to be heavy duty to be fireproof, right?
I wonder if Vhagar has arthritis. Like, do you think when she walks occasionally, like, her legs go all stiff?
Probably. They're old.
Promise I'm on the last 2 points. One of them is wearing the armor is wearing your title as armor. The insults people hurl at you. Tyrion thing about if Rhaemyra was able to publicly laugh about the concept of bastards. It's the idea, again, I don't want to bring up modern politics, but there's the concept that one of the most important political leaders in the world is incapable of laughing at himself because he doesn't have the self-assurance and the confidence to laugh in public. You never see him laugh, and a theory is that that's a sign that he has such low self-esteem that he can't find humor in things in comparison to more charismatic political leaders who are able to laugh at their own fallacy, laugh at their own mistakes, laugh along with other people's jokes. And if Rhaemyra could publicly go out and just make it ridiculous, make it an absolute, it's a laughable thing. That why would I, the queen of the kingdoms, why would I, this, you know, Targaryen princess, the realm's delight, why would I have bastards? I had the most amazing husband. He was, you know, Valyrian gold.
Wasn't gay at all.
He was the love of my life, and we had great sex. Make a big joke out of it.
Lovely heterosexual sex.
More politically convincing than her being like, beat up the peasants, they wrote a thing.
Yeah.
Like, well, you know.
That's a Daemon, move, though, isn't it? That's obviously a Daemon move.
Yeah. It's a Daemon move. But that's kind of what, like, in a way, Viserys kept the peace, because when Borthos Baratheon said to Rhaenys, "You're the queen that never was," at the tourney in episode one, Viserys laughed it off. He said, "Oh, don't worry. What's a little bit of you know, political slander? Mm-hmm. It's fine. There's no power here." And then it let it go, and it was respectable and it was charming, and it let the tourney progress without Boris worrying about being stabbed in the neck, or whichever Baratheon it was that said that to Rhaenys.
Yeah.
I feel like if Rhaenyra had learnt that lesson to be a little bit less self-serious, like to take things seriously, to be able to say, "That is ridiculous. Why would I ever do that?" Like, people who are saying that are just being absolute morons. Why? What's the logic here? Like, that's a compelling argument that also lessens the implication. Like, we've got no water to stand on. That's absolutely preposterous. It's a really good argument. So, yeah, and following on from that, the idea that it's made very clear that Orf can't read, Alf can't read, and the general populace can't read. And then also Larys saying, "I could read a little."
Oh, yeah, yeah,
And then everyone jumping on that, being like, "I can read as much as he can." like, it's a nice, like, really playing into this class divide in terms of language.
Yeah.
But
also it does reinforce the clue that the graffiti is highborn.
Oh, it's highborn.
Problem. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, and the fact that Larys knows that and understands that, even as a High Lord, obviously, because he spent time spying, while Rhaenyra falls absolutely straight into that trap.
Well, Daemon.
She falls for it so hard. Well, no, it's because Daemon's off. Is it Daemon?
Well, it's the gold cloaks that do it, so I'm assuming it's a Daemon operation.
I think it was her order, but obviously they were trained by Daemon, so their thought processes are based on what Daemon taught them, which is bloody violence. And has he confessed yet? Okay, well, we murder him anyway. So I don't think the order directly came from Daemon.
I think the
teaching of Daemon when she gave the order is what resulted from it, because again, he was what, 14 when Daemon was being a complete and utter you know, setting up his loyalty with the gold cloaks. I don't think she understood what his techniques were. So she's grateful, she's wonderfully grateful that the gold cloaks have stood up for her and even made one of the gold cloaks her one of her Queensguard.
But I
wouldn't be shocked if the beginning of the next episode is her going to Daemon, "What the fuck did they do?" And he goes, "Well, that's what they were taught, that's what they're meant to do." I can see exactly that conversation coming past in like the first 5 minutes of next episode.
Yeah, but I mean, Ulf says to Rhaenyra that, you know, "They don't like you, they talk about the bastards, da 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 da," and then doesn't she like hand wave it as like, oh yeah, she tells the Queensguard, be like, "Can you sort that out," or something like that? Is that how it goes about?
Well, I thought, I need to double check it, but I thought the guy that she hired as her Queensguard was the head of the Gold Cloaks. She switched his position.
Oh.
I'm not sure. He's got similar hair. I didn't look into it too much. I don't know if it's exactly the same actor, but just from glancing at the two dark-haired, bearded actors, one of whom plays...
Oh, wait a minute. Ulf says,
"I've seen..." of the King's, the Gold Cloaks, and the other one then becomes the new Queensguard. I thought it was the same character, and she'd promoted him between episode one and episode two because he was saying, "I need to go back to my men."
Yeah.
So we're both watching the sequence.
Yeah, yeah. You know, Ulf said, I see vile words painted on walls." Yeah, no, he's, yeah. So
I think she pretends to wave it off and then immediately is like, "No, actually, deal with it."
Yeah.
And I don't know what Daemon's doing during all of this stuff. I think Daemon's...
He's off in the Eyrie or something, right?
Daemon's up in the Eyrie because his next scene is when he brings in the head.
There we go. Yeah.
So he's not there. So he is not the one that gives the order.
Okay.
He has given the training, though. So I think I'll be interested to see whether or not her orders are deliberately misconstrued and she cares, or whether or not her orders are she understands what asking the gold cloaks to do an investigation means, and she concedes to it.
Yeah.
Because that would be interesting to know. Sorry. Yeah. And my very, very last point, I promise, this is the last thing. This was 2.5 pages worth of notes, by the way, that we've gone through, and I'm so sorry. But obviously it's 2 episodes, so it was going to be a lot of stuff. Helena. So one of the things with Helena, from my understanding of the books, is she was meant to be, like, relatively plump and joyful and kind of normal by Targaryen standards, up until the killing of her child and the blood and cheese thing. And then after the blood and cheese thing, she was meant to become kind of depressed and weird and distant. Obviously, they decided to make her the characterization that they've had of her. And there hasn't been too much of a significant change from what I can tell of her personality pre and post blood and cheese. I was wondering whether or not the pregnancy could be based on a, like, a trauma response to having lost her child, and that that resulted in her wanting another child. And also, again, we talked about the scene on the balcony with Aemond, and how that was kind of intimate, and she predicted his death, and he threatened to kill her, and she said it wouldn't matter anyway. I don't know if that specifically is a time of potential conception, but that could potentially work with the timeline, because that was, she's showing, but we don't actually know how much time has passed since that night. So that night was the night of Daemon's whole vision things, and when Aegon got burnt.
Yeah.
But Aegon's wounds are, you know, healed. He's scarred, but he is healed. And, you know, I've got a burn on my arm that I can still see from a hot water bottle scald. It wasn't like I was burnt by fire. But that's, you know, taken nearly a year to heal. Obviously, I don't have a maester attending to me, but I did have doctors that pulled the skin off. So it's been long enough since then that I think potentially she could be showing. Like, showing enough that her mum can notice at a glance. Potentially, you're talking 4 months.
She's
not showing. Like,
yeah,
obviously, it depends on her natural figure. She could. She, like, you're showing. Like, you don't show for the first, like, up to 3 months. You cannot show. Like, some people cannot show in 9 months. Like, it's very unusual. I'd say she's probably about 4 months.
Yeah.
Maybe 5 months. So, do we think the baby is going to come before the end of the story? And given all of the stuff that's happened between mothers and babies, given Helena's abilities, do you think she's already seen the outcome? There was a very interesting... Have you seen the trailer for the next episode?
Oh, I haven't. I don't think I have.
There is one shot of Helena, and she seems to be, like, surrounded by fire. And I don't know whether or not that is a real intense situation, or actually if we're going to see into one of her visions. I just wanted to put that out there, because I think that could be really interesting given the thing. But I was just wondering whether or not you had any thoughts on it, and it was just something I noticed.
I haven't seen as a general rule, I don't tend to watch the next ons. It doesn't come up on the pirate.
I don't tend to, but I've been obviously my YouTube feed has worked out. I kind of like this show, and so I keep on getting suggested reactions and trailers and clips. And there's been a couple of times when, because the internet is a horrible void of dying, there's been, like, AI generated trailers, which has sucked.
Oh no.
Yeah, it's been abysmal, and bad re-edits, which fortunately I've been able to see through, I believe, pretty quickly, and I've, like, flagged them when I can, but, like, it's been oof.
Wow.
Because I was rewatching Glidus, and obviously we've got this, which presumably feeds the algorithm the information that I like this show if I'm participating. There's been some weird stuff that popped up on my feed, but
That's one of the things I noticed in the trailer, where I was like, oh, give me more Helena. Like, I'm so excited to have Damon back to being active Damon, but yeah. I still feel starved for Helena. I still feel like Helena is one of the characters that I just want to have more of on screen.
Mm.
And I don't know whether or not that would get tiresome, but I just, I find her fascinating.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think part of her charm is that, every moment that you have with her is important. Like, it's foreshadowing. It's it's explaining the future in one way or another. So I think, because the thing is as well, is like you take her counterpart Alice Rivers, who does have a decent amount of screen time. Alice Rivers does not seem as mysterious as Helena, and I would imagine the screen time is part of it. Alice Rivers is quite a mysterious character, but with Helena, it's much more so, in my opinion. That's just the vibe I get.
Yeah, yeah. I think also by the way that she's been characterized, I feel like the way that Alice is presented is that she comes off as mysterious but has motives, and has power, while I think Helena comes off as slightly more obtuse because the way she's presented is not only in a way that is naturally uncommunicative, but also because she has she doesn't have clear motivations. She doesn't come off as someone who has clear motivations. She doesn't come off as someone who has plots and ploys. You get the impression that she doesn't even know what she wants. And that's so heartbreaking when you compare it to Alicent and have that sort of built up kind of comparison between them, that now she's like, I just want chickens. She just wants chickens and to sit under a tree with her daughter and to have her new baby. And that's all she wants. And she's, like, she doesn't have political machinations, but what's going on is still complex. She's still got stuff going on in her head that's deeply complex.
Yeah.
But yeah, I love her. I also really want to see Dreamfire at some point. I also want an explanation of why she doesn't like Dreamfire, why she doesn't like spending time with Dreamfire. There was a suggestion that I saw, which I would like to take full credit on because I've had a similar thought process, but I'm pretty sure is that the idea that being around Dreamfire triggers more of her visions in a more aggressive way.
Yeah.
So that's why she doesn't fly, is that if she, hoping to have a scene where she goes to see Dreamfire and she reaches out to touch Dreamfire, and then it's just a mass of really aggressive portents. And that's why she doesn't like spending time with Dreamfire, because Dreamfire triggers that ability in an aggressive manner. And I kind of would like to see something similar. I'd like an explanation, because Dreamfire seems like a cool dragon. And it seems weird that any character who is a dragon rider who has this deep and powerful connection to this, you know, magical entity... to not want to be around the magical entity. That's one of my hopes, that we see Helena with a dragon at some point.
Well, didn't Viserys renounce his dragon riding? He stopped riding his dragon. Isn't there this idea amongst even the Targaryens that dragons might not be the magic that they want?
I'm not sure. Did Valerion die? I thought he died. That the dragon died. I don't think he was. I thought he was old, and you know, he died of natural causes. I didn't think he was rejected. I think Daemon views Viserys's, you know, dragon dying as a rejection of his Targaryen ways, and living through. I don't think Daemon could live through if Caraxes died. If Caraxes died, I don't think Daemon could survive it. And I think the fact that Viserys survived the death of his dragon and came out of it unbroken, or at least functional, I think that's the betrayal that Daemon feels. I think he feels that the idea that you can lose your dragon and come out of it whole and functional, that's a betrayal. Because Daemon couldn't do it. Daemon could not do it. Not a chance. If Craxi dies before Daemon, he would be broken. I need to double check that in terms of Balerion. Was it Balerion that was?
Oh yeah, no, Balerion did die. He died in 94 AC, less than a year after Viserys claimed him as his mount. So what?
Yeah. So because I did find it interesting that Daemon referred to Viserys rejecting his dragon. Like I assume like that could be his idea that he moved on and survived it is a rejection of his physical dragon.
Mm.
Or it could be a sign that Daemon views Targaryenism as your inner dragon, and he rejected his inner dragon. He chose peace. He chose laughter. He chose the Hightower way. You know, after Emma died, he chose, you know, old blood rather than Targaryen blood.
Yeah.
He rejected his inner Targaryen, and that's what he thinks Rhaenyra is doing in rejecting her inner Targaryen and trying to repress that inner Targaryen and instead become this Westeros queen. That it could be a metaphor, it could be literal, but as far as I know, I think if Viserys could have kept Balerion, he would have kept Balerion.
But he didn't take another mount after that, so... You know,
well, as far as I know, there's never been a case of a dragon. There's been cases of dragons having multiple riders. There's never been a case of a rider having multiple dragons.
I think
the only one that I can think of, because I accidentally spoiled myself and I was really pissed off with myself for spoiling myself, is a future one that will be happening relatively soon in this story, which is a failure.
Okay.
Where one tries to ride someone else's dragon.
After
they've got a dragon claim to them, and the dragon drops them. Which I'm really annoyed I spoiled myself for it, because I'm like, oh no, that's going to be heartbreaking if it happens. But yeah, that I swear my notes are over. I just I feel like I love getting down in the weeds.
Yeah.
Just going, oh, but what about this?
Yeah. We better wrap it up here. It's like, what's it like? This is going back into It's nearly one in the morning.
I'm so sorry. Do you have work tomorrow?
No, not tomorrow. Goodness gracious me, no. I got tomorrow off.
Finished at 9.
And then I finished at 9. So I'm a little bit zombified right now. So let's get this wrapped up, and I'll yeah, I'm going to bed.
Okay. You cool. Go to bed. I'm probably going to have a snack and feed the cat and then go to bed.
Awesome. Cool.
Apparently Catnip says my order has been not great today. I'm sorry.
Well, we'll see
how it turns out.
We'll fix it in post.
Anyway. Cool. All right. I love chatting about this show, and I'm going to be sad when it's done.
How
many episodes we got left?
About halfway through, I think.
We're four. Is it 8 episodes a season, or is it 7?
God, don't tell me it's 7. How many episodes? Just going to have to...
Because last season was 7, wasn't it? Because it was due to be 9, and then they reduced it by 2, says with confidence.
8. It says here 8.
Okay, so we're literally in the middle. I feel like the season has been going so fast. There has been so much that has happened. Like, theoretically, episode 1 and 2 were, like, last season's, like, build-up. And, like, last episode and this episode still feel like so much happened. Like, I feel like we're sprinting towards the final. Like, I don't know if there's enough content for another season after this season, if it continues at this pace. Which is bizarre, because last season we were like, there's no way they're going to finish the story.
Yeah.
That's crazy. Like, it feels like so much is happening.
Yeah, definitely. Although on IMDb, it seems like episode 4 takes a bit of a dive. It's 7.4, whereas others are a lot higher.
I think this episode is quite unpleasant. There's a lot of the stuff in here which, regardless of production value or story value, like, it's not nice to watch. It's not nice to have Aemon, what's he called? Ormond. Ormond or
Ormond. It's not nice to have him on screen. He's an unpleasant presence. Like, you know, Ramsay was a horrible, horrible character, but you also, like, you lived anticipation of his suffering, and he seemed to take such joy in his cruelty. And same with Joffrey. Like, Joffrey you'd love to hate. You loved having him on screen because you'd be like, oh, he's the worst. There's something so nasty about Ormond on screen that every scene he's in, you don't, it's not a pleasant viewing experience. So I can see why it might get a negative review from the emotional standpoint. And it is, in comparison to, I think, again, a lot of the feedback I had from that I saw online for episode 3 was people being like, yes, Rhaenyra is finally the main character. We're finally, mm-hmm. like, actually investing in her as the primary focus.
Mm.
Rather than it being split and jumping all over the shop. And obviously they then stepped away from that this episode and went back to it being a more collaborative story. Mm. So I can see if you were, like, really excited for it to be a Targaryen madness story done right, unlike Daenerys, that you wanted to kind of keep that momentum going.
Mm-hmm.
And also that I can see the sheep stealer, Nettles, Rhaenyra combination plot putting a lot of people off. I think it's been done relatively well, but again, while watching that sequence, I was like, this is no surprise. Like, all of this makes sense. Like, I'm not...
No, I'm, like, on board with it.
Nothing about it feel anything. I just felt like, oh yeah, cool, that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
So I can see why. And again, attempted rape scenes, not a fun viewing experience.
No. It's hard watching. That's for sure.
It's hard watching in, you know, 2 attempted rapes in 4 episodes.
Albeit ones that are done better than Game of Thrones. It's
very different. Yes. Yeah. And neither of them were objectifying like Game of Thrones ones were. Mm. Like, Game of Thrones ones felt objectifying and somewhat like they were meant to titillate, which is not okay. She's like, breaking news, not okay. But I can see why, like, the momentum of episode 1 and 2 was so strong. It was such a, like, it was so conclusive, it was so bombastic. While these 2 have been slightly smaller stories with slightly more intimacy, with a slight drop in momentum, and also, again, that anxiety spiral into the tragedy. Mm-hmm. So I can see why people would react more negatively to them.
Yeah.
And if I were to rewatch so far of the 4 episodes of this season, if I were to rewatch any of these episodes, it would be episode 2.
Mm.
Like, that's the one I'd go back and rewatch with joy. Like, episode 1, I think I'd just feel like it's kicking the gut. Episode 3 is just pure stress and anxiety, and episode 4 has got a lot of unpleasant things happening that I don't want to see. I don't want to see Corlys being a grouchy guy about bastards. I don't want to see Ormond being an asshole.
See, this might be my favorite episode so far, because it feels like Rhaenyra's finally grasping some control out of the situation.
Yeah, I can also see that. I think for me, I feel like I'm on the tragedy down spiral now. So, like, anytime Rhaenyra seemingly takes a step forward and makes really positive progress, I'm like, but it's gonna be undone. it's all gonna come tumbling down. Like, she's building a beautiful sandcastle. Like, I'm so happy she found the really pretty seashells to be in the windows of this sandcastle, but you just see the tide coming in. And so I'm happy that she's happy with her sandcastle. I'm happy that she's found some nice little periwinkles. And I'm happy that she's made herself dug a little moat. Like, it's lovely. It's really nice to see. But the tide's coming in, Rhaenyra. Move your towel.
Okay.
Anyway, am I getting sleepy brained? Absolutely. Did I just fall into a beach metaphor?
Maybe.
Salt and sea.
Mm-hmm. Cool. All right. Anyway. Right. Yeah. On that note, let's wrap it up. So.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you, everyone at home. Good night, everyone at home. Toodaloo.
Yeah.